There's no ouzo talk without a bottle of ouzo, which is why we love the Greek Providor. Get a real taste of the very best produce that Greece has to offer. From olive oils and delicious artisan sweets, to unique spirits, earthy herbs and memorable wines. Visit thegreekprovador.com.au to see their amazing range. The Greek Providor, proud sponsors of the Ouzo Talk podcast. Craving something sweet? Head to Bay Vista Dessert Bar at Brighton Le Sands. Treat yourself to mouth-watering desserts, cakes, sweet and savory crepes, waffles, ice creams, and much, much more, all overlooking Sydney's iconic Brighton Beach. And now, also at Parramatta. Visit bayvista.com.au or drop on in for something sweet. Bay Vista Dessert Bar, proud sponsors of this episode of Ouzo Talk.
Sound is.
And we're back in the distillery. Nick Athanasiou, lovely to see you as always, my friend.
How good is it to be back, Tom? Did you miss it?
Yes. We've been in Melbourne for the first couple of episodes. I don't know that we actually mentioned that in the first couple of episodes, but we were in Melbourne. But yeah, we had two great episodes to kick off the season down there. And we're back now, as you say. And mate, you must be feeling good to be back in this natural habitat of yours.
I am. Yeah, look, it's great to be back. Look, familiar surroundings as well. But look, I've got to tell you, the other day, I went over to see my mum. You're not going to believe this. Had half an hour to kill. I'll go see mum. Haven't seen her for a while. And as soon as I get there, next thing I know, she's got all these fucking chores for me.
How old are you again?
Bloody hell. One, you know how Greeks have got two fridges? You know, one in the laundry and one in the garage.
Yep.
Next thing I know, I'm carting this 6-foot fridge with about... from the 1980s, full of rust, down steps, down the fucking driveway, because it was rubbish collection day.
Yeah.
Did you ever get that? How's that? And I had my nice boat shoes on, nice shirt on, whatever.
Ready to go out.
Yeah, ready to go out. She said, Nick, what hell? I said, how do you
Yeah.
Do you ever get that when you go visit your grandparents?
100%. All the time. Well, it's usually the letters. As soon as you show up, it's not even, hello, how you going? It's, can you read these for me? before you've even set foot in the joint, it's like, read these for me. What does it say? Τι λέει? Και γιατί μου στέλνουν αυτό, you know?
Classy. That's the best.
It's not so much moving fridges on my end. Classy. It's more the letters.
That is funny. I do get that. But in this particular day, it didn't end there.
Yeah.
So mum's got a massive garden, I think, I'm sure I've told you before.
Yeah.
And she's got this pomegranate tree, and it hasn't stopped fruiting a couple of years ago.
Mm.
And she's 83, right? You know, I think she's 82, but you know, Greeks round it up every... As soon as you have your birthday, they round up your age, right? So she calls herself 83 now. So she went to this tree with an axe. She did a pretty good job. And there was only like, the roots were still in there. And she goes, look, can you just get rid of it for me and chuck it out as well with it next to the fridge?
Can you just get rid of a whole tree for me and... 10 minutes?
Yeah, exactly. This is, and I haven't even sat down. Walked up the driver. Hey, ma, how you going? Hello, the fridge, and then this.
Yeah.
Fuck. So now I'm pushing this thing. I'm axing it. Fuck it. So I'll do the old-fashioned push and pull technique. Yeah. Wait for the roots to snap.
Yeah.
So I'm pulling, pushing, pulling, pushing. And I thought, fuck, I think I've got it. One big push. Snap, snap, bang. I'm hugging this tree in the fucking garden.
With your boat shoes on.
Boat shoes on, dirt everywhere. Ma felt bad. She goes, and then better. And she had this beautiful, fresh spanakopita coming out of the oven. Crispy. And the spinach from the garden that I was rolling around in.
Yeah.
But that was my greeting. So you get that as well, do you? But you get the letters.
100%. Well, it's usually the letters on our side. But I mean, you mentioned something very important there, because spanakopitas lead us very nicely into what we're talking about. Because, I mean, most people who have been following this this podcast for the last couple of years know that we started doing an island series. So, you know, focusing on an island or a region of Greece, we're revisiting that now because we're going very close to your home where the best spanakopitas are made, in my opinion, aren't we?
Definitely, mate. Love talking about this.
So, the time's come. We're going to Ipiro, aren't we? This is this is what you've been waiting for. We talk about Kerikeri a little bit every now and then, and I get very excited. We're dedicating an episode to this. And to do that, I mean, you know the region really well, but we've got a very good friend of the show's who knows the region exceptionally well. Among many other things, of course. He's an expert on genocide as well. He's an educator among educators, let's say. Panayotis Diamandis, welcome back to Ouzo Talk.
Καλώς σας βρήκα. Ευχαριστώ για την πρόσκληση. Thank you for inviting me back.
Well, mate, it was great. I mean, how good was the last episode with him?
Oh,
it was
fantastic.
Fun. It was fun.
It was fun for me. I don't know. I've, obviously, I'm back, so the audience enjoyed it as well. But
Definitely, we had a lot of feedback as well. I think we did ask in the podcast,
should we
bring him back? And we, yes, it was an overwhelming yes. So you are here, my friend. Welcome back.
Thank you to the fans, especially the ones I paid, yes.
Yeah. But look, it has to be said, you're not here as a guest, really. You are here as a guest host. So this is, you know, we're all equals here. It's not a guest scenario here. This is just a drink. This is a laid-back discussion, isn't it?
We are, mate, and that's the thing. You know, you are a historian by trade, and that last episode when you actually never left home. You never left my home, did you? You stayed for dinner.
I heard about this because I had to duck off, and it was like 6 hours later that you were still here.
We're still here drinking Tipperol, having pizzas and telling stories. We should have had it recorded. The quality and the content was fantastic, but... I guess we got him here back now, so maybe we can relive some of those stories again.
Did you note down what you were talking about in that first one?
You know what? When you get into that drinking session, you sort of forget. I forget, but hopefully you remember the Amundi.
Some of it. Right? Some of it.
Doctor, I'm sure you would have.
I was good. I was well enough that I drove home, so I do remember some of it.
Yeah.
Classy.
Well, that again, you've just led us into the next segue because it is time for a drink, isn't it?
Of course.
Definitely. Let's have a drink.
Niyamas.
Niyamas, boys.
Kalo programa.
That's what we should start saying. Kalo programa.
Yeah, I like it.
Now, we've got something new, don't we?
Needed that.
What have we got, Nick?
We do.
This is good stuff.
This is very good stuff.
That first sip was absolutely sensational.
Very smooth.
Well, we're going to where our homeland is, mate. We've gone back to Tipperol. It's called a classical spirit pea herbal Tipperol.
Classical, is it?
Yeah. What do you think of that, boys? Made from grapes. It's a northern Greek great variety, but it's from Thessaloniki. It's distilled there. So it's, I love it. What about the smell of it?
Yeah, it's got a nice aroma, doesn't it?
It's got a lot of herbs in it, doesn't it? So I think you were saying before, Nick, that there's like jasmine in it and stuff. That is absolutely sensational as a tipple. And it is pretty strong as well, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Make your eyes water just smelling it.
Well, I mean, you guys obviously have had a lot of tipuro in your life, you know, being from Ipiro. Number one, what's good about the tipuro in Ipiro, and how does it compare to this?
The tipuro that I usually have from Ipiro, it doesn't have the flavor of this one. It's usually just very, very plain, just as powerful, just as strong.
Usually pure ethanol, right?
Yeah, you could run, especially the first batch that comes out, you can definitely run the tractor or the car on it, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. So I guess we've evolved now, and this is, like you said, it's got a hint of jasmine and there's mint in it as well. Look, it's gone to a new level, you know.
And it comes to us again from our good friends at the Greek Providor, who, again, fantastic to have them on board this season, sponsoring this segment of the podcast. Thank you so much to Crystal and Greek Providor. Look them up online, greekprovador.com.au. There's fantastic stuff, isn't there?
Yeah, they have. And look, if you want to taste Greece, go to their, I think it's their pantry as well. So they've got everything in the bar section. They've got, I think, a 10% discount now as well. So get on there now. And,
that's dangerous.
I think it was free shipping as well, anything over $150.
So, really?
Nice.
Yeah, so good to get on there now. So Greek Providor, thank you guys. We love you guys. You guys are champs.
Just on them as well. They've been featured quite heavily in the latest edition of Gourmet Traveller.
I saw that. Yeah.
It's huge.
So they're importing this quality Greek oil, and it made, the Gourmet Traveller, which is a...
no small feat.
Yeah, which is a really premium type of magazine here in Sydney or in Australia.
Australia, yeah.
Suits Greek Providor down to a T. Thank you so much for being on board, guys. And as you would have heard in our intro, thank you to Meet the Greek for coming on board for this episode as well. Thank you so much, guys. Mourgios family, fantastic Greek food, guys. If you haven't been and you're in Sydney, you need to go.
Yeah, definitely. Check it out. And look, the whole restaurant is built like you're in a cave.
It gets that feel, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a mountainous cave, which sort of goes on with what we're going to be talking about. You know,
in a good way, though, right? A nice cave.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And the portions, mate, forget it.
Oh, portions, crazy.
No, the portions are very healthy.
Yeah, yeah.
So don't over-order because the portions are massive, especially the meat. You'll end up taking meat home.
Yeah.
And you always for the next 3 days.
And it's quality. That's the most important thing, isn't it?
Thank you, Meet the Greek.
Good stuff. Absolutely. All right, so.
Well, let's, yeah, Nick. Shall we kick it off? So I guess we've already heard your credentials, Bunny. So
you probably don't need
to hear it again. Or no, our listeners, don't. More for our listeners.
Go back to the genocide episode. If you haven't heard that, that gives you the full lowdown on Panayotis' biography. As we said earlier, you know, very learned and very knowledgeable about all these things, mate. You're a busy man, aren't you?
Very busy, but it's fun.
Yeah, it
otherwise,
is.
Why bother?
Yeah. Exactly. And you're passionate about it. That's the key thing.
Absolutely.
Mm. And the good thing is, so you are a historian, and I guess my first question is, there's been evidence of people in Ipidor back at the Stone Age. Mm-hmm. I believe you know a little bit more about this. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
One of the wonderful things about Ipidor is that because it's so sparsely populated and relatively isolated for a couple of hundred years, there hasn't been very much development. So a lot of this old Stone Age and prehistoric sites are still there and still being able to be excavated. So they haven't completely overdeveloped it, like Attiki, for example, or around the Thessaloniki. There's places like Horitsa.
So just on that, so I guess we should touch on the geography as well. So it's surrounded by, you're saying, mountains.
It's got mountain ranges on three sides. So Ipidos, for those of you who are not familiar, is the northwest corner of Greece.
Mm-hmm.
So literally across from the best Greek island, Kerkera. Hold on, I had to say that.
Checks in the mail.
Come on, we will do an episode.
I will completely upset my Catherian, Mytilenean, Crete, especially the Cretan friends will kill me. But I had to say that, you know, just the environment.
Love it.
And it's only got sea on one side, so it's unlike most of Greece.
So the Pindos mountain range, they say it's the spine of Greece.
It's the spine of
Greece,
yeah.
Yeah, and it divides Ipidor and
Macedonia and Thessalia.
Yeah, perfect.
So the upper end, the northern part of Pindos separates us from the Kozani and Florina and Kastoria districts, mm-hmm. so that part of Macedonia.
Mm-hmm.
And you come down a bit and you cross over and you go into Trikala, or Meteora is most famous.
Yes.
Or a bit further south, Karditsa.
Mm.
And then you get down into central Greece.
Yeah, beautiful.
That basically has shaped the whole region's history. That geographic isolation has shaped the culture, the people, the history, the development of the place ever since.
Mm. So it's called, is it the Pindus mountain range?
Pindus, yeah. In Greek, Pindus.
Pindus. So is that part of the Alps?
Only in a really distant way. It goes up from Peloponnesus, essentially, mm-hmm. from Megasteria Elava, right up through Greece, through Albania, up through Serbia, separating Bosnia and Croatia, then running up the side of the Adriatic Sea, wrapping around the top and joining the Alps, roughly with a corner where there's Slovenia, Austria, and Italy meet. So essentially, it is one big long mountain range.
Wow.
And that's because of the... Okay, let's get really technical now. The tectonic plates. Mm-hmm. So there you got the... Yeah. This is why it's formed.
It.
This is why Crete... The mountains of Crete run the other way.
Yeah.
They run east-west, whereas the Pindos goes north-south.
Right.
Because Crete is where the European plate and the African plate meet. And that's why when they push up against each other, that's how you get the mountains of Crete. That's what the island, those mountains and those islands are.
Mm. Very interesting.
But now we're going too far.
Yeah,
no.
Well let me ask, as the only person who's not from Ipidoi, I mean...
You're outnumbered.
Yeah. but I mean, the stereotype of the, you know, when people... Other people in Greece think of Epirotes and whatnot is that whole thing with the Fustaneles and up in the mountains and, you know, some pretty rough and heavy people that, you know, the hard drinking and, you know, fiercely independent and whatnot. You mentioned they're being cut off.
Yep.
What has that actually done in terms of the development of the culture there? Because it is pretty unique there, isn't it?
It is unique. It's very unique. And cut off... as in there was no easy access. Even when you run up and down the coast... From the coast, I mean, not far from Nixkodios, not far from the coast, but go inland and you smack right into mountains that make our blue mountains at the back here look like molehills.
Yeah.
All right. You can go from the coast and with a couple of kilometers, you're at 2,000 meters altitude.
Yeah.
So you talk about hardy and hard people, and the only way you could survive was to be tough.
Mm.
There is no great plains where you can farm, so you're relying on... scraping little plateaus here and there, little ridge arachula, as we call them.
What's that? Sorry,
arachula. Just a little patch of farmland. You,
right. Okay.
You literally flatten a little space, dig out all the rocks, and that's your garden
that's
patch.
Your
that's your grain patch.
Gotcha.
Except for small patches around Arta, around Brevezan, around Yanina.
Yes.
The rest is basically just rock.
Yeah. Okay.
So Epirotes became very good builders, stonemasons, by necessity. That's the building material, to the point where even their traditionally the roofs are made of stone, not tiles. And that's more for practical reasons rather than any environmental.
Yeah.
It's just there's plenty of it.
Yeah.
So they learned how to split the slate to make roof tiles.
Yeah.
Which required really thick timbers underneath to carry the weight. Yeah. Now, properly built, these things last for centuries.
Well, they're still there.
A lot of them are still there. My place would still be there if the Nazis hadn't burnt it. To a Yul Dimitriu in 1943. My Horio is part of Dana district.
Okay.
Not particularly the really high range, but still, it's highlands. So most of the villages, even the ones that are high up, tend to be in spots which face the sun. There's an old joke about someone, a little boy, watching the news and shouting the weather report to his dad. Hey, Dad, it's raining in Yanina. That's in September. And then the months roll by. Hey, Dad, it's raining in Yanina, and it's now March. again, because of the mountain range, Epiros is one of the wet. It's probably the wettest corner of the country.
Yeah, right.
Simply because that's the weather's, as you know, just here in Australia as well, the weather comes in from the west. So the rain systems build up over the Ionian Sea, smack into the mountain range and just sit there.
Yep.
And dump most of their water on Epiro and then go over the mountain range. So
that's one of the, very green.
That's one of the reasons it's so green.
Yeah.
I love the variety of green of the place.
Mm.
You got the back of Sydney and you've got the different eucalypts and, you know, occasionally the kind of pine tree. You go outside Yana or you go between Yana and Iwuminitsa.
Yeah.
And there's a dozen different shades of green within eyesight. And then you mix in the grey of the rock or the red of the, if you're in the volcanic area, and it's just the colours are just amazing. And this is one of the reasons that it is so physically beautiful to the eye. But because of it's been so isolated for so long, transport-wise, people don't really explore it as tourists. Don't really visit it unless you're smart enough to have married an Epiroti or an Epiroti son. I'm not going to be praising you, Mona.
What's the line? That's the one.
There you go. Boom.
Love it.
Right?
Translate that?
Yeah, for the Hellenically challenged.
Yeah.
if you don't praise your own house, it'll fall on your head.
Yep.
Yeah. True.
And it's true.
It's true. So I personally love the place. I lived there for a few years when I was a kid. So I developed personal memories with the place, particularly with Yanina.
It's absolutely stunning there. I've been so many times, and every time you go there, there's something different to discover.
Oh, really. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And even all the rivers as well. We talked about the Hironda River, but I want to talk about the Kalamas River.
The Kalama, yep.
Which was called, in ancient times, Tiamis.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any truth in this, that the Thames in London was named after the Tiamis River?
It's
spelt similar, T-H-A-M-E-S, very
it's
similar.
It's one of those. Who knows? Quite possibly, because we know that when Alexander the Great, don't worry about the Macedonian side of things, that his better half was his Epiroti half. Because He took after his mum,
yeah.
Who was, of course, a princess of Epiros. Her brother was the king at the time.
Mm-hmm.
When Alexander sent off to finish the conquest of the Persian Empire, which his father, in fact, had started. So this is one of the reasons maybe Philip was assassinated, not so much because he annoyed Olympias, although that definitely played a role, but also because he had started an invasion of the Persian Empire. He had crossed over and taken control of what we call Troy.
Mm.
So he'd crossed over at Gallipoli. Does that sound familiar, that place?
Mm. Not at all.
Not at all. Gallipoli. Iomorphipoli. That's why Gallipoli is written with double L.
Mm.
The double L is beautiful, whereas the single L is good, galon.
Yeah, right.
That's the difference.
Okay.
Very symbolic for Australians, for American or Northern American friends.
Yeah, it's as important as Iwo Jima or Guadalcanal is in American military history.
Mm.
Definitely.
When Alexander went off east, he sent a fleet to map the west, a guy led by a guy called Pytheas.
Mm-hmm.
We know that he produces the first maps of the east coast of the island of Britain, so England.
Oh, really?
Right up into Scotland and across to Denmark. Germany, Belgium, Holland, those whole coastlines. He produces the first maps. This is the 4th century BC.
Wow, I didn't know this.
Would he have gone up what we call the Thames? Absolutely.
okay.
Especially at its mouth, the Thames is huge. So naturally he would have thought, okay, I've got to explore this because is this an island or is this a river? So he would have gone some way up it, at least, and maybe even named it. We don't know. But we do know that the Celts and the Greeks did have trade links long before Alexander's time and long afterwards. So could some Epiroti have gone either trading or even married there up there?
Conceivably.
Absolutely, yeah. Quite conceivable. Because unlike what the modern time of Epiro,
yeah.
In antiquity, because we didn't have the Suez Canal, we didn't have the Corinth Canal, some of the ports of Epiro were major trading centres.
Mm. The connections go even further, I guess, and I'm not sure what the chronology is like, but, you know, even Scotland itself.
Skotia.
Skotia. It's named, it's a Greek name as well.
Okay, so is that...
Greek settlement,
is that
though?
A fact?
I don't know.
It's more than a coincidence that... Well, Scotia became Scotland, whereas in Scottish, in Gaelic, it's a Laba. You don't call it Scotland.
So the Greek name won out in the end.
In the end.
So Scotia in Greek means dark.
The dark place,
dark
the dark,
land.
Land,
dark lands.
Yeah. Which if you go there basically for three quarters of the year, it does look pretty dark.
Mm. Overcast.
It's always constantly overcast. It's just you know, you're on the edge of the North Sea. This is normal.
A bit like Epiro, maybe?
No, we get a bit more sun than that.
Epiro is far better.
We get a far bit more sun than that.
Yeah.
And not quite that wet.
Okay, so look, back to the Stone Age. So you're saying there is evidence now that people lived in these caves in Epiro, what, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 BC? How far back does this go?
No, we're talking Stone Age. So we're talking about 500,000 BC.
Way further back.
Okay, Stone Age ended, I think, 4,000 BC, didn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Beginning of around the beginning of recorded history. But we've got fossils of animals that had been butchered, and by butchered we literally mean you can see cut marks on the bones. So somebody had chipped off a blade or made a blade out of stone and cut the meat from the tendons on the bones, and the bones are left over in
so
these
that's
caves.
How, that's what Stone Age is. So
yeah, the dominant tool is the stone
in a sharp or a flat object where you can cut. So there's evidence of that in Epiro. What? 100,000 years?
No, up to 500,000.
Half a million, wow.
Up to 500,000 years old. So particularly the main sources are Kokino Petritsa, Goritsa, Kastritsa. Kastritsa is that little Ayers Rock lookalike thing at the south end of the lake in Yanina.
Yes, okay.
There are some caves in there with evidence of habitation with animal bones, like the Aboriginal middens here in Australia. Basically the rubbish dumps, the shells that they would leave over, the bones that would be left over, and... particularly the caves at Perama, next to the Yonah Airport. Another little mound, because you've got to think that back in the day, back before the last ice age, what we call Kastritsa and Perama were islands. The lake was much bigger and much deeper than it is now. They were islands. So the lake extended right down to almost the set of Yonah, for those of you who know the Yonah district. And right up Eleusa, all that plain of Yonah was all water, was all marshland.
I mean, it just reminds me, this is the thing that comes up every time someone over there goes to build anything anywhere in Greece and they've got to excavate. The local council always has an archaeologist associated
absolutely.
With it. Wherever you dig, you're going to find something. You go to Athens Airport, for example, and it's a mini museum upstairs of everything that they've found, with a diorama of this is where we found it, this is where it is in connection to where you're standing. Yep. Just imagine how much, when you're standing there, what you're potentially standing on and that we just don't know about.
Absolutely. Yeah. My little Horio, which has maybe 500 permanent residents, Gala in summer, it goes to 5,000 because half of Athens comes up.
Yeah.
There's actually got two museums. Mm. It's got the Lao Grafico, so the folkloric museum, which includes some of this antiquity stuff.
Mm.
And it's got a modern art museum.
Yeah.
You wouldn't expect a little Horio outside Yana to have an modern art museum.
Mm. With abstracts in it.
Made by a guy... who was from the Horio.
Really?
Yeah. He left the Horio. He became a professor of fine art in the University of Athens. Mm. Oh, Supoliteknio. The university in Athens. And when he retired, he goes, I'm not going to let the schoolhouse die. Beautiful old stone building, classic like in Yana. Tumusio Papayani. There's a plug for it.
Make sure you go next time.
So the upstairs is all his work, his art. Wow. And he loves using, and very environmental, very ahead of his time, he only works with recycled materials. So he takes the offcuts from, they'll do some stone work.
Mm.
He'll take the offcuts and turn it into modern art.
Wow. Okay.
So I took some rusty old metals, shaped it into a giant snake, and stuffed it with aluminium cans. He was doing this 50 years ago when I first met him when I was like 5.
Hang on. Okay, so this is 50 years ago.
And he's still working now.
This is in the Horior, right?
Yep.
What were people in the Horior thinking seeing all this stuff? Because there must have been people like, "Kani aftos o anthropos?"
Ακριβώς.
Είναι καλά.
There were.
Really?
Oh, είναι καλά. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now that the tavernas are doing mad business, because especially in the warmer months and the school groups come up, uni groups come up, they're saying it's the best thing since sliced bread. But this guy's a genius.
Mm. The tune has changed. What do we even at Akani?
Yeah.
I told him to do it.
Of course.
I praised him all his time.
Of course.
Then me akusha.
Yeah.
And yet there's his museum.
Classic. Wow.
And it's the top floor of the old Dimotiko Skolio. Thankfully, downstairs is still the Skolio Komiparchi.
There you go.
With, I think, six students still. Something like that.
Mm.
These villages are dying, just like in Australia. I don't know about America, but I know in Europe, and especially here in Australia, rural centres are dying. Everybody's moving into the cities.
I don't know where exactly it was. It must have been on one of the islands, I think. But last year, around Ecospede Martiu, there was footage of a parelasiu in one of the villages where there was like one kid holding the flag, and that was it. That was the whole part in last year.
And the teacher. Don't forget the teacher.
And the teacher, sorry.
Come on,
yes,
don't forget the teacher. Gotta get the teacher's credit.
Go the teachers.
But yeah, one student in the whole, in the whole town.
Yep.
Mm. Unbelievable.
Yeah,
it's crazy. I bet you it was one of those islands out near Kalimno. What's it called again? Folekandros, one of those really...
You might be right, actually.
Out of the way. Because I remember seeing it on TV as well. They keep it open because we do need to keep people on these places up in the mountain. We do need to keep these communities alive. Mm. Yeah. We can't all live in Athens. We can't all live in Sydney.
Mm. We're going off topic, but I was going to mention... Let's take one more off topic.
That's why we love this bloke.
I know, it is. We're going to be here forever.
Yeah. But, no, we're not.
This podcast is going to be for six hours.
Nobody will listen to us for more than an hour and a half.
That's what Nick Giannopoulos said, but we've got the evidence to
support. I love that episode, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
It's huge.
It's all Nick.
Thanks, Nick.
Of course it's Nick.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
It's the Nick show.
Remember Peter Menaeus, the Lady of Roe?
Island. Well.
Yeah, so that was the same sort of thing. She was on her own, elderly lady.
Widow,
Widow, and every morning she'd get up, raise a Greek flag. Yeah. Didn't want to get off the island because I think Turks were
trying
to claim it.
You know where Yeasty?
It's near
Kastelorizo. Yeah. It's just to the left. She got old, she passed away.
Well, the story broke out and the military went there. Now the military are based there and they've built a monument in her name and they put the flag up every day.
And there's actually a guy that has taken her place.
Oh, really?
So it used to be Kiratis Ro, now we have Okirios Tis Ro.
Oh, really?
So someone is a permanent resident, because the military comes and goes.
Mm.
There is a permanent resident who does exactly what she did.
Yeah.
Raises the flag every morning, brings it down every evening.
There you go.
Have they put him there, or did he just
say,
"I'm going"?
No, he wanted to. Wow. He heard about the Kiratis Ro story. He was, I'm pretty sure he's a widower, and decided, I can go to a monastery, I can go here. This is more important geostrategically.
Yep.
That's a whole different episode. And we've got to organize someone way better than me on that point. And this is why Megisti is so important. And I'll make one comment about it and then we'll go back to Epiro. Because it actually does tie in.
Okay.
It gives us a maritime border with Cyprus. It's actually not even Megisti. It's the island to the right of Megisti called Strongyli. Or Strongyli, depends on your pronunciation. The round one, Megisti, the big one, and Ro. Sounds like Larry Curly and Moe.
It does.
The Greek version.
Yeah. The Greek version. And because of Strogyli, we have a 25 nautical mile border with Cyprus. And the forecast, the pipelines that they've done deals about to build, electricity cables, pipelines from Egypt and Israel through Cyprus to Greece and then to mainland Europe, go through exactly that spot. So once it leaves Israeli or Egyptian waters, it's in EU waters all the way.
Geopolitics.
Now let's go back to Epiro, because the same principle.
Little does he know that Gideon of Ro is.
This is why he was so important. Thinking, how are we going to make sure that this little? It's literally a rock.
Yeah.
All right. It's a couple of the whole island's a few acres in size. Yeah. It's literally a rock in the sea.
But we know how important rocks in the sea in Greece are.
Yeah. And when it comes to Epiro, I'm not sure if you've been up there, but Othoni.
Yes.
The ones above Kerikeira.
Yes, I was just there last year.
They play exactly the same role as Kastelorizo, but with Italy and Albania.
Yep.
We were there.
Actually, we were both there together.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right. Othoni, those little rocks above Kerikeira.
Yeah. Apparently, Odysseus went there.
Yep, it was one of the, one of his stops.
Calypso yeah. Beach.
There you go. Mm. So speaking of Odysseus, actually we touched on Alexander the Great's mother. So Alexander the Great, he claims that he's a descendant of Achilles.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a guy called Neoptolemy, which was
Neoptolemos.
Neoptolemos, which was Achilles' son. And mm-hmm. he was there in the Battle of Troy, supposedly. Yep. Yep. And he was in the belly of the horse that went in and he killed Priam.
As vengeance for Priam's son killing his father. Mm. Yep.
Correct. So, is he a descendant of Epiro?
He became...
Or he ended up in Epiro.
Legendarily, the first king of Epiro.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Because originally, as you know, the Myrmidons, so Achilles' people, were mm-hmm. Thessalia. They're from Thessalia.
Okay.
And he then came across and basically bashed the heads together of the local clans. Those of you in, particularly in the UK, you've got to think of Epiro like the Highlands of Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
Very clannish, very my little patch of rock is my little patch of rock.
It's a good comparison, actually.
So there was 14, my understanding.
Yeah,
14 exactly. tribes. The Molossans were the...
In a space the size of nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what names are we talking about here? What was the one that you...
So Molossans were the
dominant
main guys?
Ones were the Molossi. Okay. The Molossians, yeah.
And Thesprotia.
And Thesprotia.
Okay.
Yeah, which is now a region.
It's a district. It's the western part of Epiro. Thesprotia, that's Nick's family's...
Yep.
Region.
Protithesi.
Yeah.
Protithesi.
But I mean, when it comes to those sorts of claims, you know, lineage to Achilles, I mean, we see that in Egyptian culture as well, you know, descended from a king, you know.
You see it in popular culture. You see it on Game of Thrones.
You see it in Christianity as well, you know, with the...
Yeah, the lineage, yes. Yeah,
like
Jesus is from the house of David.
Exactly.
It was an ancient and continues to be the way you show your status.
Yes,
by
correct.
Being the descendant of this... famous whoever it is.
Yep.
I've got a friend whose surname is Kapodistrias. He's related to the first governor of Greece, yep. Ioannis Kapodistrias. Mm-hmm. There's someone I know in Melbourne whose surname is Kolokotronis. He is from the family of Kolokotronis.
Wow. Really?
Mm. He's a descendant of he's part of that clan.
Wow.
There you go. Far out. Okay, so good. So we can tick that off. So Neoptolemy. So we did debate if Troy actually happened, the Iliad, because it was...
I'm in the camp, yes, it did.
Because Homer wrote it, 400 years after supposedly it happened?
Well, Homer couldn't write, he was blind. So
it was
He composed the poem about 400 years, we think, ballpark. It wasn't written down for about 800 years. So it was Chinese whispers for about 800 years. So
okay, so well, instead of going for a year, we ended up 10 years. Yeah, that sounds like Chinese whispers.
Yeah. But, so well, yeah. It's what Professor Paul Cartledge said on the episode
where he said
it probably only lasted 10 days in reality, but then they sort of stretched it out and
maybe it went a bit longer.
Years.
Yeah, hey, the storytellers, man, I know the story. I'll tell you what happened.
It's like when Nick scores a try in Oztag. It was like 1 meter out, and he's saying it was length of the field.
Of course. The field's only 100 meters. I ran 200 meters to score.
Yeah.
Or the old jokes about the hunters. Either Nyar Kuda. Nyar Kuda. And it was a little bear cub.
Yeah.
You know,
it was a possum.
Or a possum.
A fish this big.
Yeah. It becomes like Jaws, but it was actually a guppy. You know?
Classic. And then from that, we got the Iliad.
Yeah.
And this, more importantly for us, the Odyssey.
Mm, definitely.
Because Odysseus, to find his way home, goes down to the underworld. And one of the entrances...
Beautiful place.
Nicely done. Nice segue.
I love that. Yep. I'm getting goosebumps. This is where I was going to take you,
so
actually.
So this is the Acheronta River?
The Acheronta.
Yes, that's it.
The Necromandio.
See, I listen.
You do.
About time.
I was there a couple of months ago. Beautiful. Amazing place.
Problem with being a Yagnotti, I don't get down to that part of Preveza very much. But one of the mythical entrances to the underworld is the Acheronta River.
Correct.
Which most of it is actually underground.
Mm.
And only the last bit of it that comes out near Preveza.
And you can actually go there. So they built restaurants there now, so you can eat. But the water is freezing. It's mountain water. It's freezing.
Oh, don't try and go swimming in any Epiros lakes or rivers. Unless you like frostbite.
Come on, mate. I went in. We all went in. Me and my boys went in.
Yeah, how long did you last in the water? A minute?
Mate, we went on a day. It was like 40 degrees. Yeah, I don't remember in July.
But see, we're part of like the cold shower crowd.
Yeah, okay, cold shower, ice bars.
Yeah, yeah. Nick and I have been doing that for the last few years. Yeah,
we used to jump in Botany Bay in winter.
That's not cold.
I know, is it warm?
Well, it was there.
It was for us.
Different level.
But yeah, look, so that...
For those who don't know Epiros rivers, you put a watermelon, a full-grown watermelon in there, in less than 10 minutes, it's perfectly chilled. And this is because the rivers are very shallow and very fast flowing, so they don't get time to trap the sun's heat. So they're crystal clear. You can almost drink the water.
Can you drink it?
Yeah.
You can. If you go to the
close to the springs, yeah, absolutely.
Correct. Yeah, we were feeling, there's a place where, because a lot of tourists go there now, and there's a bit where you can walk where it's like knee deep, sometimes waist deep. But when you see water come literally out of the rocks, that's the bit that you can drink.
You obviously tried it.
Definitely.
You must have.
Yeah. I never got to minerally.
Oh, it does.
Yeah. I just felt the inside of my mouth couldn't absorb this. I just really wanted to absorb this water. I don't know what it was. I felt like I was just, maybe it was hot, I was dehydrated. And had a sweet taste to it as well, I think.
Depends on the soils. Coming back to my choreo, I haven't mentioned it. My choreo is called El Nico.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, it's just outside Danana. It's got three different natural springs. Mm. The water of each one tastes different.
By the way, the crunching you can hear is Nick.
I won't hide it. Sorry.
Don't hide it. It doesn't matter. This is relaxed.
I'm deliberately not eating the nuts for that reason.
Just get into it, mate. Well, it doesn't matter. Among friends.
All right. It sounds good on a podcast.
We should top up at this point. Sorry.
We should, definitely.
We're 40 minutes in. Yeah. Come on. Give us a top up then. Sorry.
More tipper.
Panayoti. Keep going there, mate. Fascinating stuff.
So Odysseus sails down to meet Tiresias, which for me personally has special reference because my late aunt was Tiresia. The female version, yeah.
Jeez, man.
And meets the spirits various, including his father. Mm-hmm. He bumps into Achilles, Hector, and gets guidance as to you've annoyed the gods, so you're going to suffer a bit, and eventually you'll get home to Ithaki. Mm.
And also, going to the underworld, what do you have to do? You have to pay the ferryman.
Mm-hmm. And that's why our people used to leave a single coin under the tongue.
Under the tongue.
On the eyes.
Yeah. And one of my great aunties still got buried like that. They still try and keep that tradition to this day. And there's this famous song about it as well. I'm not sure who sang it.
Yeah, we mentioned this on the podcast, I think, with
we did.
Okay. With George Ellis, I think it was. Who was it? I can't remember.
Yeah, don't forget to pay the ferryman.
Was it a Rolling Stones song or something?
I wanted to say David Bowie, but I don't think it is.
No, we can Google it.
Let's check that.
We can Google it.
Check that.
Who pays the ferryman? Is that what it was called?
Look, whether it's a funeral or whether it's a wedding, Epirotika Panigiria, any celebration in Epiro starts with a dirge, with a miroloi.
We were listening to this just before we started to get us in the mood.
This is my most favourite music to listen to.
Really?
My students constantly ask me, what's your favourite music, sir? And it's like, I mean, these guys aren't going to go, is he speaking Greek again?
Yeah.
And I've done that in class, by the way.
Yeah. But that song, Metalloy, And every, again, I guess probably got to put a bit of context to it. So if there's ever a festival or a get-together of people, this is the song they play.
It's a collection of songs. It's more of a style rather than a particular song. It's a style of very heavy clarinet basically by itself, perhaps with a defi, so the hand drum, or a violin, but typically the clarinet by itself.
Mm. And the purpose of the song is for you to think about the people that aren't here at the festival. They've either passed on or they've left. They've gone to another land, for example. As you know, it's very mountainous. You know, it might take...
It's poor. It's a poor region.
Yeah, 6 days climbing up and down a mountain to get to the nearest town, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, we heard that too. And Thekapedavgustu went to my parents' village and it was beautiful, you know. It brought back those good memories as well. But that piece is, from what I read, it's probably over 1,000, maybe 2,000 years old.
It wouldn't surprise me. I'm not a musicologist, but it wouldn't surprise me.
The interesting thing to me is the name, obviously, because, you know, I remember as a kid, you know...
The name Epiros or the name Miroloi?
Miroloi, because... Yeah,
we'll get to that.
Because, I mean, I remember, you know, like my mum, you know, my yao or someone, you know, you're sitting around kicking stones, you're upset, whatever. Yeti Miroloi, yes, you know, like, can you just explain what that actually means?
It comes from Mira, fate.
Mm. Right.
Why are you cursing or upset with your fate? It's your fate. This is your lot in life. Suck it up, or as we would say in Australia, man up and deal with it. So these are songs that are mourning the dead, but also mourning the ones who have migrated.
Because I always equated it with wailing, you know, like it's like a grieving type of thing, isn't it?
Which is why typically the ones that have lyrics are almost always to do with funerals, with death. But there are a couple, Yanni Mutomandilisu, which everybody's heard. Dolerose ixenitia.
Explain that.
It's the foreign land. It's the experience of living away
the
from
home. The
foreign
land tarnished it or stained
that
it.
That has stained my my mandili, my kerchief, which you would wave to say I'm back or to say goodbye.
Yeah. Because they played at weddings, and in particular the bride's family played because they're
she's
saying
leaving
goodbye
the house.
To the bride.
Yeah.
Correct.
Who knows where she'll end up?
Yeah.
She may end up in the next house.
Yeah.
She may end up in the next quarter year.
Another village.
She may end up on another side of the planet.
Or another country.
You think about... I mean, we're coming up in a few weeks. We've got the celebration of the liberation of Yana in 1913. Next month is Independence Day. Independence Day associated with the Eteria των Filikon, the Society of Friends. Two of the three founders were Epirotes. And where did they make their money? Where did they get big? Russia. Away from home.
Yep.
Averov, I mean, both of you must have been, a lot of our listeners would have been to the Averov in Piraeus Harbour, the battleship, Greece's first battleship.
Yep. Yes.
Paid for by Nipiroti, who left Metsovo, his family from Metsovo, to Egypt, made his money in cotton. So it's always these people who left.
Yeah. So it's their diaspora that are keeping the motherland.
The US has a huge number of Nipirotis.
Amazing. A lot of great Nipiroti that's there. Can we ask you, I think we have to strap Tom in here. So the word Ipiro.
Oh, here we go. You had to bring it up, didn't you?
I had to bring it up.
You had to bring it up.
Tell us, mate. How did Ipiro get its name?
I wish the camera was on Tom's face right now.
Oh, here we fucking go. Am I going to get upset or am I going to get
happy? Oh, the exact opposite.
We'll have a look. Come on,
originally, Ipiros is Apiros. Apiros, yeah. Mm-hmm. And even the Federation of Epirotes in Athens, they're subheading, because you know, Epirotes, all our Asylogi, they love having a special name. So it's, you know, Osylogos, what is it? Pilea to Navarino.
Yep.
For the Epirotes, it's Apiros, yeah, or infinite land.
Right.
The name Epiros was given to it by the islanders across the water from Epiros.
Okay. Sorry.
So the kid. Because when you think about it, you're standing on an island or you're sailing past and you see this vast, massive mountains and you go, you know, Apiro. It looks infinite.
So you know, named us, mate.
It became Epiros.
But to that point, I mean, you're quite right because, you know, when they do look over the ocean, they do say that's Epiro. There's this sense that it's the whole country.
This is why in modern Greek, the word Epiros also means continent.
Continent, correct.
It's the same word.
Oh, wow. Yes.
Translate. When it's with a capital Ita, it's the place, the origin Epiros. Mm-hmm. When it's a lowercase Ita, it's continent.
There you go.
Amazing, huh?
Because from their point of view, as we said, from the point of view of people sailing past or living on the islands, it did look like
a continent.
Like a continent. It looks like, you know, a whole different world. Because Gedgeta's pretty rocky, but still it's got some forests, it's got the water, it's got limits. This is this massive rock across.
It's got Palio Kostritsa. Yeah. Classic.
Most part of the world.
Wow. Okay, so we touched on Neoptolemy. There was a So Olympia's father was a Neoptolemy, wasn't he?
Yep, and her brother was an Alexandros.
Who was
the king of Epiros.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about him? Do you know much about Neoptolemy at all? We discussed the 14 tribes. Mm-hmm. So Molossians were the main tribe.
They came to dominate the others, basically because, just like in all... So why was Mycenae Agamemnon's place? Why was Sparta the centre of that region? Because it was the centre of the wheat and the grain-growing area.
Ah.
So the Molossians controlled the valley of what we call Yanina, the main grain-growing area.
Yeah.
So they became the richest, therefore the most powerful.
Okay, it's all based on food.
So they came to dominate.
Okay.
We can't live without food and water. It's just that simple. Mm. So those who control the food and the water are the rich.
Because you keep on saying geography is so important in history.
Can't study history unless you study geography. Mm. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
My geography teaching friends love me saying that.
Well, you're right, though.
It's true.
All right, so he had three important kids, didn't he, in Neoptolemy? Mm-hmm. So Alexander was one, Olympia was the other. And the third one was...
Okay, so Pyrrhus comes along. Pyrrhus is Alexander the Great's great nephew.
Okay. So Olympia's sibling's child.
Grandchild,
correct.
Pyrrhus became, in his turn, the king of Epiros.
Mm-hmm.
By this time, the Romans are a rising power. They've conquered Italy. They've knocked out the Carthaginians. and they're now moving into the Eastern Mediterranean, into Greece. So he fights them. Actually, no, they haven't knocked out the Carthaginians yet. They've won the first Punic War, not the second one yet. And he introduces a new battle weapon against the Romans called an elephant.
Okay. Which would have come from Alexander the Great's...
Oh, no, there were elephants in Greece.
Oh, really? No.
Yeah.
You're kidding.
Look it up.
Is that a fact?
Go Google it. Where are, if not the world's record for mammoth tusks, definitely some of the biggest have been found in the Pindos Mountains. They're actually on the other side in Revena. There's something like 16, 17 feet long. That's the tusks.
Okay.
All right.
We know Alexander the Great brought them over from India.
No. These were fossilized. They're on display now in Revena. It's one of the towns on the other side of the mountains from Yelena.
Yeah, you're right.
He's never wrong, mate.
Oh, no, I am wrong.
No, you're not, mate.
My wife tells me I'm wrong all the time.
That's different.
You're always wrong, mate.
Just suck that up, mate.
Miroloi, mate.
I've got the best comeback to that, and my wife hates it when I say it. She goes, whatever happened, your fault. Yeah. It's Dizlel. She goes, what are you talking about? I go, mate, I asked you to marry me. You said yes. You had the last word. It's all your fault. She hates it when I say that.
Love it.
Sorry, Olympia had a sister called Troas.
There you go, Troas.
And Troas' grandson is Pyrrhus.
Is Pyrrhus.
So that's a connection to Alexander the Great.
And he thought he could fight and keep the Romans out of Greece. Mm-hmm. He failed. They had way more resources, basically. He did win the battle, and he goes, If I win one more battle like that, I'm done.
Yeah.
So how do we say this in English? A Pyrrhic victory.
Okay.
It's named after him.
Yes.
So it was the two battles. He won one, and then he won another, and after the second one, he goes, mate, if I have another battle like this...
I'm done.
We're done.
We're done. This belongs on an episode of Horrible History, Stupid Deaths.
Is this the tile?
The tile.
On the head? Yeah.
He's going through Argos, the city of Argos in Peloponnesus. And one version of the story is it was deliberate, it was an accident. Anyway, someone pushes a tile off a roof and smacks him in the head.
So this is the Ben-Hur scenario, basically. Is that where they got it from?
Probably, actually.
I think it was the other version.
This one would actually hit him, did kill him, because these tiles are not our little flimsy ones. These were solid clay.
The stone
ones. Yeah, these were probably one of the stone ones.
Yeah.
Well, they say there was a duel. So a guy challenged him. And he beat him and his mum threw the tile.
Yep.
The guy that he killed in the duel, his mum threw the tile in his head. That's
why
he didn't have a helmet on, because he was fighting and he lost his helmet. I don't know.
There are different versions, Chinese whispers.
But he was 39.
The fact is he was a successful general, but...
Yeah, to a tile.
And he's 39. He wasn't old.
He wasn't old. Oh, look, for that...
What was the average age then? 40, 50?
It depends. For royalty, 39 was not particularly old.
Mm.
For a labourer, you're getting into old age.
Mm.
Ready for retirement.
Well, that didn't exist. If you retired, you didn't eat. Which is why they had the council of elders, their advisors, are always with the white beard. So they'd be in their 50s, getting into their 60s.
The wise ones.
The wise ones, because, you're wise enough to have lived this long.
Mm.
No, it was literally like that.
No, it makes sense. Absolutely.
When you think about the one-third of people didn't get to puberty, they would die of childhood diseases, cold or hunger. If you've made it to your 50s...
Mate, you're doing well.
You're doing well, really well. You're blessed by the gods, and therefore you're a wise person. We're going to be here till next weekend.
No, that's okay. Well, look, as long as... Well,
on the whole thing of, we keep sort of mentioning conflicts in the region.
Yeah.
Again, let's go back to a bit of the stereotype around the region that the rest of the Greeks sort of think. Epiro is known for its freedom fighters. It's, people that are tough and hardy, taking rifles up into the mountains, mm-hmm. up against the Turks and whatnot. Is that sort of justified in the sense that, this is an essential part of the Epiro tradition that, number one, we're fighters? How do you guys see it, coming from there?
I'll do the analogy with the Highlanders of Scotland, or the Cossacks of Russia, Ukraine, or the Ozarks or some of these mountain regions, the West Virginia of the US. If you're not tough and if you're not independent and quick thinking, you die.
Mm. I mean, you look at photos of his family that he's shown me from family members that were in the army around World War II and whatnot. Man, these are serious individuals. These are not people you want to meet in a dark alley.
And you're talking about the guys, not the women.
Mm.
He's talking about the women.
The women are even tougher.
Yeah. Big hands.
Well, think about it. With the men, typically with the herds, if you're lucky enough, your family's lucky enough to have the herds, half the year, especially in the summer, the warmer months, they're up in the highland pastures feeding. Like, they're not in the hoyo. They're not in the village.
Yep.
So who's farming the fields?
Yeah.
Who's raising the kids? Who's maintaining the house, keeping the roof leaks off?
Actually,
it's the women.
Yeah.
So they become very skilled and very tough.
Yeah. Also, I didn't realize, I only found out recently, there was a Molossan dog.
War dogs.
An Ipirotico dog.
Yeah, yeah.
Which special apparently breed it's extinct dog. Now. Yeah, it's a proper breed.
It's basically extinct. It threw into breeding, basically it's extinct. But there's a famous sculpture of one in the Archaeological Museum in Athens. Think about the wolfhounds, the Irish wolfhounds.
Yes.
Double it.
In size, you mean?
In size.
Really?
Not so much in height, about the same height, but double it in bulk.
Just thick.
These were big-ass mastiffs. Okay. All right. These were big dogs, and they were trained for war.
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
And they used to protect the home as well, children, all that sort of stuff.
But the mountains in those days had lions.
Actually, I was going to say that before. I mean, you mentioned elephants and
mammoths
and
stuff. Yeah, there were lions. The not Epiros, because it was too cold, but you go down to the Kyklades, the Aegean Islands, they found fossils of pygmy hippos, pygmy rhinos, prehistoric stuff.
We're not talking about mountain lions like our friends in America.
No, we're talking about European, Mediterranean lions. They only became extinct in the Middle Ages when they were basically hunted to extinction.
Yeah, right.
But these are big lions. You look at the famous lion hunting mosaic of in Pella of of Alexander with Cassander.
Mm-hmm.
And you get look at the proportion, get an idea. These are full-grown lions. These are not little things.
Mm.
Wolves, bears. These roaming the forests of Epiro.
Yeah.
So you needed a guard dog.
Yeah.
So the dogs become very big and are bred to become very aggressive and very big.
Mm, definitely.
And they were used in war.
Well, there was definitely a famous statue. I think it was a Roman statue of a Epirotico.
It's a Roman copy of a Greek original, yeah.
Ah, is that what it's in the British Museum as well. So if you have a
shock
around. I wonder how they got that.
The greatest warehouse of stolen antiquities. Let's move on.
Classic.
We have touched on that before, obviously.
We have. But look, you're talking about...
You've got to love... One of my favourite exhibit at the Yana Archaeological Museum are the Catares. Now, these are scrolls of lead. Why lead? Lead in nature always exists with silver. You extract the silver because you want the coinage.
Mm-hmm.
And the leftover is the lead. So they would make sheets of it, inscribe Katara for whatever reason. The most famous one is, may he never be happy because until he comes back to me.
So what's Katara mean? What's that?
Curse.
Oh, curse. Okay.
Curse tablets. If you Google curse tablets, there's a whole collection of them in Yanina.
Okay.
In the Yanina Museum. because where do you put it? You don't see, typically with gods, you burn things. We now burn incense.
Yes.
The old would burn a sacrificial animal or part of it to the gods. So the smoke rises.
The entrails.
What do you do with these curse tablets? You bury them because you want something dark to happen to your former lover, someone who stabbed you in the back, whatever it is. So you pray to the gods of the underworld, the dark gods.
Mm.
So you bury these curse tablets, which is why we've got them.
Tell me more about this. I want to know how we do.
Yeah. So if you want to, I'm just thinking a metal collector would be going now. Beep, 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 finding all this.
I'm not sure lead gets picked up by metal detectors, I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm not a metallurgist. This is one of the best examples of the Pella curse tablet, found at Pella in Macedonia. One of the best examples of what the average Macedonian spoke, not the royal court, Alexander and Philip, the average farmer.
Mm-hmm.
It's written in a really highland, peak dialect of Greek, of Doric, similar to what they were spoken in Epiro.
Mm. So we spoke a Doric dialect.
Doric dialect, related to what the Spartans spoke, which the Athenians would love making fun of. You sound like a hillbilly.
Yeah.
No, literally. And it's like, yeah. And
there you go.
I am a hillbilly.
Classic.
Very, very rough. And you think about it, even if you think about it today, the joke is that Epiro was so poor that they would eat the vowels when they speak because...
Classic.
Think about the way Epirotes speak.
Yeah.
Bum spit.
Yeah. Shorten all the words. That was all to talk quietly. So
not bum spit, spit. Bum spit.
Bum spit. Yeah.
Not even store spit. That's too much. They're very laconic. They're very short and...
That's very true.
The dialect is very simple, very direct.
Mm. Do you guys say tzadzik instead of tzadziki?
I don't speak the dialect very well at all.
Yeah. So I heard...
I've always loved that.
See, in the mountains, I heard they had to be quiet because it was, you know... With the Ottomans and all that sort of stuff. And is that why they had two-syllable surnames as well?
Probably. That's how it probably developed. Because really, until the Middle Ages, Greeks didn't have surnames. Mm. Only the wealthy would bother with.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, think about it. Your surname. The son of?
Arthur. Yeah, correct. Athanasio.
Athanasio.
Yeah.
All right. The southerners would say Opulos. Same thing.
Yeah.
The Eastern Greeks.
But we're very unique. So my great-great-grandfather was Pappus. He was the priest in this town. And then he had a couple of kids, Lucas, Athanasio, and then they became the surnames. Lucas clan, Athanasio clan, and so forth.
Yeah. But, or nicknames like mine.
Yeah.
Our family name, the Amandius.
The Diamond.
The Diamond.
Rough Diamond.
Was a nickname. No, yeah. Someone actually says Diamond in the Rough.
Okay. There you go. Good stuff. So look, speaking of, warlike people, let's talk about the Souliotes now. So the Souliotes came around when Greece was occupied by the Ottomans.
What we know of is that the people moved up into the area, the region we call Souli, the district we call Souli, sometime about after the Ottoman conquest. So the Ottomans took over Epiro in the 1350s.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
About 100 years before Konstantinopoli fell. And there's another story about that, how Yanina actually was taken, because it was a major metropolis, it was a major center.
Mm.
When the Romans took over Greece, I'm going right back now. When the Romans took over Greece, they built a new highway, the Via Egnatia, or the Via Egnatia. We call it the Egnatia Rhodos.
Okay. There you go, which takes you all the way to Constantinople.
And from then, it used to go from Dyrrhachio, Duresh, in what is now Albania, down to Yanina, and then across basically the way it goes now. Thessaloniki.
So the Romans would march along this particular
path.
And trade. And now it's a road.
The part of it in Greece basically follows the same route the Romans built, pretty much, except for through the mountains. They're a little bit different through the Pindus Mountains. The modern ones are a bit different. It was a major trading centre. It became very wealthy.
Mm.
What most people don't know is that the Metropoli, the Archdiocese of Yanina, is the second wealthiest archdiocese in Greece.
Really?
Only the Archdiocese of Athens is wealthier. Basically, the whole of Yanina city, the old part of the city, not just the Castro, but all that district around the lake, it all belongs to them.
Really?
Everybody rents from them. And this goes back to Ali Pasha's time in the Ottoman period.
Mm.
They simply grabbed all the land. They came from Trikala, so they followed the flat lands.
The
Ottoman army crossed the Pindos. Freak snowstorm hits, and they simply walked across and knocked on the gates of the fortress and said, "Hello, open up, we're here." And the defenders are like, "Where did you guys come from? Because the road is... the road to Athens is the other side of the fortress, not where they were knocking."
Mm.
And they go, "We just crossed the valley." And the defenders are like, "What valley? You just walked over the lake. Mm. You guys walk on water. It had frozen." and that happens very rarely. The last time the lake, there were chunks of it actually last winter.
Mm.
But the last time it actually froze completely is about 70 years ago.
Which is ironic because the liberation of Yanina is, what's the date?
21st of February 1913.
There you go.
Last year was the centenary. No, 110 years. And so the Muslim general, Ottoman general who captured the city, then opened up basically a Muslim monastery, a dervish place, Durrahami, at the spot where he began crossing the lake when they worked out that's still a school. It's an orphanage, effectively. They're still functioning today.
Yeah.
Wow.
You can see it diagonally across from the fortress.
Amazing.
But this is why land of myths and legends and all these stories and all these come together.
Amazing.
There you go. So talk to me about my people, the Souliotes.
Your people.
Mate.
Hard people.
We have.
So the ones who didn't want to live under the rule and under the taxes, basically. Because let's be blunt, who likes paying taxes? Went up even further into the highlands. Now, if you've been to Souli...
Just on taxes. It was a Christian tax, wasn't it?
There were separate taxes. There were taxes everybody paid for business.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the additional tax, apart from the Bill of Muslim, which is another tax. There was an additional tax that only...
Non taxes? Sounds like Australia.
We're nothing compared to that.
We don't have pedo majoma, though. Or babula.
Ooh, babula tax.
Babula tax. The pesto. That only non-Muslims would pay. Christians and Jews.
Ah, right. Okay.
So for the privilege, basically, of being allowed to remain Christian or Jewish, you'd pay a tax.
Yeah.
Annually.
And that's why some of them did convert, so they didn't have to pay the tax.
Yep. Yeah. And that's how you ended up with Greek speakers, Muslims, mm-hmm. and Greek speakers, Christians. Mm. And when the War of Independence started, they fought together because they were related.
Mm.
They're not going to fight each other. They're not going to fight their own blood.
Yeah.
Unless it was a rival clan who we didn't like, but let's not go there. So 1300s, early 1400s, they go up into Sulu, which is really hard. I don't know how they lived up there.
It is, and where my parents are from, it's all cliff face. Mm. One little squiggly little road that goes in. And then when I was there, I was in the village, and I said to my uncle, I said, is this here? He goes, yep, this is the famous Labanitsa, it's called. So it's like a, I think they called it Parasuli, like a suburb of Sulu. Mm. It wasn't the main town of Sulu. And there was a lot of
Sulu is a number of villages, basically.
Well, Sulu is a region, isn't it?
It's a district, yeah.
Yeah, it's a district. But there was a main town called Sulu, wasn't there? Yeah. So, yeah, so this was it. This was the town. In this town, there was 2,000 people lived. Mm. And it was just amazing how they all were subsistence farmers. They'd all help each other out. If someone got married in the village, all the men would get together, build a house. And like you said, the houses are still standing today.
Yeah.
And they're like 200-300 years old. Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
And our American listeners will remember that this is the way the West was built. The whole community would get together and do a barn raising.
Yeah, right.
Or a church raising, whatever needed to be built.
Yeah.
They'd all get together, they'd do two, 3 days, and they'd build it.
Yeah.
But everybody pitched in. This is the only way that these people could survive up there.
Was there a lot of skirmishes with the Suliotes around that time?
Especially with the Albanians who controlled the farmland down below.
So the Albanians came in as well?
Of course.
Controlled all the good farmland?
Of course, because the Albanians were played the role like the Kurds did in the Middle East for the Ottoman Empire. They were the local policemen. You've got to remember, the Ottoman Empire, we'll talk about the Ottoman Turkish Empire.
Mm-hmm.
The Ottoman Empire was, while the elite were Turkified,
mm-hmm.
most of the people on the ground actually being governors, especially in Europe,
mm-hmm.
were either converts to Islam or Albanians. And the Albanians themselves were converts to Islam. Originally, most of the southern Albanians were Orthodox, and some of the northern Albanians up towards Montenegro and Serbia, that corner of Albania, were and still are, about 10% of Albanians are Catholic, mm-hmm. Roman Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
The most famous one, Mother Teresa, but she was born in Skopje, still part of that crowd. So they operated like the police force. So the Suliotes over time, as the empire weakened, particularly after, and we talked about the croissant last time.
we did, yeah.
Particularly after the 1600s when it started to decline,
mm.
the Suliotes and other such mountain groups started doing their own taxes on businessmen coming past. If they knew you, there was no tax. But if they didn't like you, there was a tax. Yarmatoli ke ikleftes.
Okay.
So now we're talking about the 1700s, 1800s.
Yeah.
Okay. 1700s especially.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And this is where they learnt to fight.
Mm. Very interesting.
Because of these taxes, basically highway robbery.
Yeah. Literally.
Literally.
Yeah.
The Ned, in an Australian context, the Ned Kelly or the American context, the Jesse James of the area. They became very, very good fighters. They learnt how to use the terrain to fight.
Mm.
So when the War of Independence started, and this is, it's amazing how much the world knew about what was happening in Greece generally, but especially in Epiro at the time, because shortly before, Ali Pasha was an Albanian, we call him a Turka, but he was Albanian, from a town called Tepeleni, hence nicknamed Tepelenlis. The local ruler, he wanted to set up his own little empire. He made his son the governor of Trikala. He made another son the governor of Moria or Peloponneso. He himself had there. He had relations with the British and the French and everybody. Because remember, you know, Parga at the time was not Turkish.
Mm.
Parga at the time was the French.
Venetian? Oh, French.
French and then British. When after Napoleon, the British took it over.
Oh, right. So Turks never went to Parga?
No.
Wow.
It's one of the few little
and Preveza.
Preveza they did. They did rule for a while. But the islands off the coast, like Kalamos, which is Baksi, Kerkira, never.
Yeah, because Parga, Preveza, they've got amazing castles there, Venetian castles.
Yeah, that's originally Venetian, then the French took over after the Venetians, and then the British after the French.
Ah, there you go.
So
that's why we have such big fortresses there, mate.
Yeah. Mm. And this is, and Barga was one of the main entrances, because it was British, for British visitors doing the grand tour of Europe and visiting Greece.
Okay. Mm.
Now, the most famous one was there. Now, let's just say it. He was there for the boys, literally. You know who I'm talking about.
Yes.
Lord Byron.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wrote a fabulous little couple of books, a couple of chapters in some books about his time in Yanina at the court of Ali Pasha, and including a poem dedicated entirely to Ali Pasha. Very praiseworthy. No, I'm not going to get into it. anyway, he did spend time
with Ali Pasha.
With Ali Pasha.
Just Yanina. Look it up. Look it up, everyone.
Yeah, you've got to look up the poem. You've got to look up his writings about Yanina. And there's a number of these travelogues of people going through Yanina and talking about just how wealthy the place was.
Because he did. And I read he never built a Muslim mosque. He built Orthodox churches.
He only sponsored Orthodox churches because long-term... The man was a smart cookie.
Yep.
Long-term, he goes, look, most of my subjects are Christians. If I'm going to break away from the Sultan and set up my own country, my own state...
I want support of his constituents.
I'm going to need these guys' support.
Yeah.
Was that ultimately his goal?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, the Turks ended up killing him.
Yeah.
Then we get the War of Independence starting, 1821, and don't let the Peloponnesians say that they started it, because they didn't. The Pondians did.
Did they?
The first battles in the War of Independence were up in Romania.
Yeah, wow.
On the border between the Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire.
Really? And they were Pondians?
Most of the fighters were Pondians. The Ypsilantis family that were leading them were Pondians.
Mm.
Wow.
There you go.
That's the first battle. This is February of 1821.
Okay.
In Peloponnesus, so it started in March. That's true. And because of nation-building reasons inside Greece, it's 25th of March is the Independence Day.
Okay.
Even though the actual fighting started 5 weeks earlier.
Okay.
But that's Astoft. Ali Pasha took advantage of the fighting on the Pruth River in Peloponnesus to declare his own independence.
Mm.
He had a revolt. He lost it. A few years earlier, he had met a wandering monk, Christian Orthodox monk, who was really weird for his time.
Cosma?
Cosmas Huetolos. Patro Cosmas, Father Cosmas. Why was he so weird? What would you expect a holy man, a monk, to advise the faithful?
Mm.
To build what?
A church.
He goes, stuff that, go build schools.
Mm.
He's renowned all up and down Western Greece, from Patra right up into what is now Albania, into Vori Epiro, for founding schools and advising people build schools.
Wow.
This is 1700s, late 1700s. Patro Cosma, you have the gift of prophecy, I hear. Which he did. Am I ever going to go to Konstantinopoli, to the imperial capital? Remember, it didn't become Istanbul until 1936.
Oh, really? Hmm. So it's still Constantinople.
It was officially at Constantinople until 1936. Go through all the old newspapers of of World War I of the 20s. Mm. It did not change until 1936. Patro Cosma, tu lei thapas me kokina genia. You're going to go to the imperial capital with a red beard.
Mm.
But this time, Ali Pasha was an old man.
He was
white as snow.
Yeah.
Retotrello. Ah, this crazy old coot. Yeah, no worries. What happened to him? He loses the revolt. He's shot to death on the steps of his holiday house on Greece's best island, Tonisaki Tsayana, little island in the lake, which is so good. What's the name of the island? The island.
The island. See? It's that good.
It's that good. It's Donisi.
The island. Well, actually, if you do go to his house, you can actually see...
You still can. You can still see the bullet holes.
The bullet holes from the floor.
Mm-hmm.
So he shot from underneath the floorboards.
Yeah.
Wow.
They would keep their animals under their houses. There's a couple of reasons. One was security, obviously. Mm-hmm. But also, natural heating.
Okay.
Think about the warmth of the manure, of the gases of the animals. It would naturally heat the house from underneath.
Mm.
And, you know, Greece, Yanina and Epiro generally needs heating six, 7 months of the year.
Yeah.
You need extra heating, even today. So anyway, they cut his head off as proof that he was dead. Doused it in honey. Why honey?
To preserve
never
it.
Rots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Honey never rots. Sent his head to Konstantinopoli.
Thus the red beard.
So he did go to Konstantinopoli with a red beard.
Cosma knew.
Wow.
His body is buried in the castle next to his wife. Well, next to his favorite wife.
She was Greek.
No, his favorite wife was an Albanian.
His last wife was Greek.
One of his other wives, because he was polygamist.
Well,
it's good to be king.
His main wife. Or his last one was Greek.
His last one. Vasiliki.
Yeah, that's it.
His harem was notorious, right?
Yeah.
Depends which way your moral compass goes.
Yeah, sure.
If you're into that thing, he was awesome. Yeah. But if you're not,
yeah.
If you're a humble man, like the sensible men are, one life, one wife. His grave is.
He
still,
wants to say more, but he's
just have no. Have another sip. Resisting. Tipro's looking at you. Have a sip. Yeah.
You're up in the castle.
Yeah.
Right next to the zamir, the one that's characteristic, right at the highest point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In front, there's an iron cage.
Yeah.
That's his grave.
Okay.
The iron cage is his grave.
In the island.
No. On Sukastro.
Oh.
In the castle, inside the fortress of Vienna.
Really?
In the inner citadel.
Oh, right. Okay, I'll pay attention next time I'm there.
Picture it.
Yeah.
Or next time you go to online or whatever, you see the characteristic zamir, the minaret.
Yes.
On the point.
Mm-hmm.
In front of that, literally between there and the kitchens, what used to be the kitchens, now it's a very nice coffee shop, is an ironwork cage.
Mm-hmm.
That's the grave.
Yeah.
That's his grave. So his body's there, but his head is... Yeah. Lost. God knows where it is. Yeah. If it even exists.
Well, they had to prove that they killed him.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. The Sultan needed proof that he was dead.
Yeah.
Wow. So the Suliotes were very practical fighters. So they go, hang on. Apart from our muskets, when we're going close up, you're not going to use a musket. You're going to use a sword. Mm-hmm. So the easiest way to kill someone is to cut their heads off. Now, how do I stop someone grabbing my hair and cutting my head off? So we cut our hair short in front. But because we're Greek men... We need to have long flowing hair like Achilles. And like all of them until Alexander. Alexander made it fashionable to have short hair and clean shaven because he couldn't grow a beard.
Is that why?
That's according to legend anyway. But fact is, he's the one who started the trend of shaving.
Okay.
For he ordered all his front men to be clean shaven.
Mm.
So the Suliotes would have shaved head in front. And if you look at the paintings of them.
Yep.
You can see it, the shaved basically in front. Basically, it's what we in Australia call a mullet, which I personally think is a crime against fashion and humanity.
I love it. But so short front and back.
What do the Americans
front and side?
We look this up. What do the Americans call it?
That's the right. Kentucky waterfall.
That's the Kentucky waterfall. So the American listeners, it's a Kentucky waterfall.
If you're not sure what a mullet is, American friends, it's a Kentucky waterfall or a beaver paddle.
A beaver paddle. Yeah, that was the other one.
The other one.
Europeans, you're just going to have to Google it.
Hang on. So you're saying Iberoides invented the mullet?
I am saying that the Suliotes cut their hair for a very practical reason. For in battle, that they used that hairstyle. Did then somebody copy it? I cannot put my hand on the Bible and say, yes, it happened. I don't know.
All right. Can I go as far as saying if I see someone with a mullet, say, mate, you got an Iberoides haircut?
Please don't. I'm trying to distance Iberoides from this crime against humanity.
Mate, you've got a Suliote haircut. Wait, I'm going to say that to everyone. Hey, mate, that is a Suliote haircut, so mate.
For the record, then.
The Suliotes would be proud.
Yeah. So for the record, then, did Greeks invent the mullet?
Apparently. if we go on the paintings of and this is 200 years ago, so it's not like yesterday. All right, some of these earliest paintings we have of them are from Ali Pasha's time, so the beginning of the 1800s.
Mm.
So just after the American War of Independence. So it's a long time ago. Kentucky wasn't even part of the US back then.
I think we've got to claim it, Nick.
Yeah,
let's claim it.
Let's claim it. We've claimed everything else. We may as well claim the mullet.
The three of us
are
never going to wear a mullet, so...
No.
Yeah, no. Or maybe we might have to,
Did you do that in your youth?
A mullet?
A mullet?
I think I tried it.
Did
for
you?
A little bit. Yeah, I tried to grow the long back hair. It took ages. And I hated it.
I let mine all grow out.
Oh, did you?
I had hair
I couldn't grow long
I
hair.
Had hair halfway down my back.
Because my hair goes curly.
So does mine.
So it doesn't go long. It just goes curly.
Yep. Shirley Temple locks bookless like that.
Yeah.
But when it was wet and brushed, it was literally halfway down my back.
Wow. Really? So I had to use gel. I had literally a handful of gel to get it straight.
You'd go through a pot of gel a week.
Yeah. But that's why I thought, oh, fuck that. I'm going short.
I've got to say, though, the mullet's come back in the last few years. I use the NRL as a bit of a barometer for where haircuts are at.
For boys, yeah.
The shittest haircuts. I have ever seen in my life.
They are horrific.
The last 3 years in the NRL, the mullet's back. They've got there's fucking even in the AFL, it is absolutely horrendous.
Well, in league, maybe there's a bit of they're going to war. Suliotes.
Nah.
I don't know.
No.
Shit.
Yeah, it does look shit.
Non-Australian audiences, please don't look these haircuts up unless you want to look at what you should not do in terms of hairstyles.
What's Melbourne's fullback called again? Pappenhausen, isn't it?
Pappenhausen, mate. He's got
Ryan Pappenhausen has the shittest haircut I've ever seen.
That head is hideous.
I love it. Now that I know that Sojourta's had it, I love it. It's a great haircut.
Great haircut. Yep.
Mate, well done. All right. Well, that's the best.
My favourite part about Ipiros is obviously the cuisine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you opened up with this panakopita.
Yep.
Mum's panakopita. Now, why did they become so good, such good bakers? And why pites?
Well, I'm going to have a crack at it. So, obviously, out in fields and in all that sort of stuff, they've got to have something easy to carry and something that's going to last. And both of those things happen. Yeah. Well,
There's no refrigeration.
Let me tell you something, right? So, the best spanakopita, I've got to give it a shout out now, right? The best spanakopita, pita full stop, that I've ever had in my life is from a really good friend of ours who's from Ipiro, Athina. Zanga is her last name. You probably know people with that last name.
Actually, my grandmother's maiden name was Zangas.
Very good. So
distant cousin.
Potentially.
Is she fair?
She is fair, actually.
Yeah. Distant cousin.
Yeah, she's very fair.
So is my grandma. Fair, blonde, blue-eyed.
Who lives in Athens right now. She makes...
This Athinasto or Furnos.
Yeah. She makes the best pita I have ever had in my life. And one trip... So my sister-in-law was coming out from Greece... Usually because Athena lives in Athens, my sister-in-law would go and stay with her for the evening and then fly out the next morning. She decided to make a pita for her to take, to bring to Australia, put it in a Tupperware container. I don't know how the hell she got it through customs, whether that's an issue or
because
not.
Because
it's cooked, apparently, so it's fine.
That's why. I was about to say that.
And I absolutely
hammered
it.
2 days later, and it didn't reach a third day.
Mate, I hammered it. It was amazing.
Yeah, they never last long at my house. I told you my adventure. Went over to see my mum and all that, and she made the spanakopita bitter.
Yeah.
A couple of days later, she's got this massive mango tree in the backyard, and they're ripening, all the mangoes. Mm-hmm. I might give you guys some. I've got some here.
Oh, you got some?
Yeah. Oh, excellent.
Beauty.
There's dinner tonight.
Yeah, there is.
Incidentally, though, Greeks hate mangoes.
Really?
I don't.
We love them here, but in Greece, they don't get it.
Okay, sorry, I've continue. Overdosed on them. So I went over, and this tree is fucking huge. So I had to climb up this tree, and I'm sitting there with a rake pulling him down. With no joke, we got, you know what a milk crate is?
Yeah.
We got 4 milk crates of mango.
This is a mature tree.
Yeah, it's huge.
Is there an avocado tree somewhere close by?
Next door. The neighbor's got one.
That's why.
Yeah.
Apparently you need to have, if you've got a mango tree.
No. Next door here at my house.
Oh, no.
But I know what you mean. I heard you. Yeah.
Apparently, if you want them to fruit properly, you've got to have one of each within relatively close proximity.
Yeah.
I'm not a green thumb, I don't know.
They're both tropical fruits, so makes sense.
Well, my reward for, no joke, I was in this tree, fucking twigs were going in my ears, in my fucking eyeballs, fighting.
You could picture it, can't you?
Yeah, I'm up there trying to rip this shit off and reaching out. Anyway, I come down, I go, Ma, that's it, I'm done. There's a few up there, I go, I'll come back tomorrow. And she goes, oh, okay, Anafame. She made me a marakonopita.
Oh, yeah.
Fucking beautiful.
Mate, this is a concept. Feta. I think that was the one that introduced me to this concept as well. She made one when she visited us in Kerkira. Where has that been all my life? Seriously.
Makaronopita?
Yeah, I'd never had it before.
You must be joking.
I'd never had it
really?
Before. Yeah.
Oh, my God. All right, we've got to get you some.
She showed it to me. I'm like, that's a thing? Seriously?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd never had it before.
My God. And again, wow. Crispy. She makes the filo fresh.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Literally, I've had half the tray, one sitting. So me and my brother, we always fight over it. So that don't last long. So that was my treat.
Thessaloniki throughout Athens and Diaspora. Ipirotes are famous for as being bakers.
We fucked this up because your mum should have made one for this episode.
Yeah, we should have.
We stuffed this.
Next time, Dax.
Why didn't we think of that?
Mate, next time, come over. I'm sure she'll have some jobs for us.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
and the Ipiroti says...
We'll probably get a kreatopita or something.
The Ipiroti says... famous for turning anything into pita.
Yeah.
Almost anything can be turned into pita. Kreatopita.
Kolokitopita.
Oh, the best.
You like that one?
You know what's my favorite?
Go on.
Prasopita.
Yes. Oh,
leek pita.
Yes. Yep.
It's just got that perfect balance of sweet and sour.
Yeah.
And
when I was a kid, I used to hate kolokitopita.
Why?
Because of the word kolo. I used to think,
it's bums.
When I was a kid, I'm not having fucking bum pie. What's that?
when you think about the pumpkin, it looks like a bum, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's what I thought when I was a kid.
Well, now you just offended every American on Thanksgiving with their pumpkin pies.
Yeah. Oh, I love it now, but when I was a kid, okay, I had that image of an ass. I go, Ma, oh, tito, am I in bum pie? Ooh. It's like bum yes when you're kids. Yeah, fuck yes.
You've said this before. Yeah. Bums. I don't want to eat bums.
I'm not having bums. Ooh, ma, dinafto, yuck.
But come on, though. Fuck yes. Like growing up, I loved them.
Yeah.
Especially if they were made well.
How do you do them? How do you eat them?
There's two ways that we do it.
Because my wife says I always use my lotions and potions in it.
Well, there's two sort of basic ways, that differences basically. There's one that's actually got like tomato and tomato paste in it.
Yep.
It's still got the garlic and the onion and all that sort of thing. The other one just doesn't have the tomato in it.
You put those celery and carrot? Do.
No.
So we do.
But how do you eat it? Beyond what your wife or mum or whoever makes it for you.
Mum does it.
What do you put on top afterwards?
I'll put on top vinegar.
Balsamic, of course.
Yes.
Excellent.
Okay. You know, we go onion, garlic, celery, carrot. You put a little bit of tomato paste. Mm-hmm. Mum chucks in a bay leaf now and then.
Yep. It's got to be there.
Which you don't bite into because it gives you a trip.
As you're cooking it, you put it in. You can take it out afterwards when you start eating it.
As a kid, you'd always cop it in your plate. It's like, what the fuck?
Yep.
What are you cooking this underneath a tree, Mum?
Why is there a leaf in here? So go on.
Classic. That's it. And then I'd use lemon, fresh lemon. I prefer lemon.
Yeah. I've got to drown it in olive oil. I put more olive oil.
Okay, sorry.
And balsamic vinegar.
That goes without saying.
And chunks of feta.
Yeah, beautiful.
Really?
I love it.
I've put in chunks of feta. It becomes almost like a broth.
Yeah. Vovoni?
Only vovoni.
That's it.
Well, right in front of you is goat's vovoni.
Yes, yeah. I've had a slice. It's gorgeous. Especially since the few goat herders left in my horio, I to give their milk to vovoni.
Really?
It's only vovoni from our village is about 10 kilometres.
Yeah, I've been past the factory a few times, actually.
Mm, really? It's in that district.
But when you have your fakesh, how big a loaf of bread do you need to have to accompany it?
Half a caravelli.
Yeah,
you got to go.
100%.
Come on, look at me.
You're a very healthy man.
You've got to have a half a loaf of pesto sourdough.
Frazzola, as we say.
Or a big Vienna. Rip it
half
up.
Half a Vienna. Yeah. The old Viennas.
It's got to be that heavy village bread, you know what I mean?
So you put it in there and you've got to leave it in there so it soaks in.
I'm getting hungry now.
Love it.
Bloody hell.
But well, this is why the traditional Epirotiko diet is very vegetarian. They wouldn't slaughter animals very much because they needed the animals for the tricha, for goat hair or for the wool. They needed the chickens for the eggs. They needed the few cattle that they would have, or the sheep or the goats for the milk. So they wouldn't slaughter them very often.
So
what else would they typically have?
They would eat fish or the lake fish.
Right.
Before they stuffed up the lake. They polluted it.
What about Yemi star? I'm sure they would have had that there.
Yeah, for sure.
But that's all over Greece, I think. Actually, most of the dishes are all over Greece, but what's tradition Epirotiko food, apart from some of those pittas?
Oh, they're famous, but especially in the mornings, you have your pesto morepali.
Oh, the cheese?
The bugatsas.
Yeah, beautiful.
Oh, bugatsa.
Bugatsa.
Really, is that ours?
Oh, bugatsa. Epirotis, Yaniotis are famous for bugatsa. Yaniotis, bugatsa. You go to Thessaloniki, there are shops.
Or Yaniotis,
Yaniotiki bugatsa. Yeah, for sure.
People in Thessaloniki claim that, so it's ours.
Everybody claims it.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, wow, okay.
It doesn't really matter. But I'll tell you what, Michael, you can claim, apart from the...
Truffle's big in Epirotiko.
Oh, yes.
Mushrooms, yes, for sure.
Mushroom, truffle.
For sure.
And was it frog's legs?
Only in Yanina, only at the
they
lake.
They do that, yeah.
Okay. And snails?
And heli. I've never had it. Yeah. I've never
What's
eaten
heli?
It.
I have.
Eel. Lake eel.
Oh, okay.
You can go to the Nisaki, you go to the island, and they're in tanks, and you can pick one out.
Mm. Yeah.
And they cook it up for you straight away.
Yeah. Is that near the Tsipro bar?
Next door.
How many Tsipro bars are there in Yanina?
Not enough.
Mate.
If anybody is thinking about, especially from the States or Europe, going to Yanina, you must go in the beginning of January, soon after New Year's. Because like in Kastoria, they have Ragutsaria. It's basically Tsipro making festival.
Yeah, and Tsipro is a winter drink, by the way.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, you can't have it in summer. It's too hot.
Thank God today is reasonably cool.
Yeah. Well, January is technically winter in Greece.
It's winter somewhere.
Yeah.
But all the shops... will have barbecues at the front and just shout at passers-by, parane souvlaki, parane meze, whatever it is. Mm. And here's a shot.
How good's that?
Just on the word barbecue, I'm going again, I'm digressing. I'm doing barbecue. Barbecue, it's actually a French word.
And that explains the spelling. I didn't know that.
Yeah, apparently it's a French word. And it means when you souvlissi something, like a goat, from ass to fucking, no, beard to ass. That's what it means.
Really?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, beard to so ass. Apparently. Yeah.
The French are weird.
Barbecue. So apparently the word for ass is cool. And barba is beard.
There you go.
That I knew. The barber, that's why we got barbers, as in barbershop quartet sort of stuff. Yeah, it's beard, but I didn't know the other bit.
You just reminded me of something, though, that happened in episode one of this season, right, with Nick Giannopoulos, right? You remember how we were talking about masticha, and you mentioned, what did you used to call chewing gum as, yeah, as a kid? You know,
masticha.
Most of us called it masticha as a kid, whereas Nick said tsunga.
Tsunga. Tsunga. Yeah. Oh, I haven't heard that.
Mama, hello, tsunga.
Yeah.
Until I heard it on Nick's.
But yeah. Nick actually, you know, Nick went through the process of saying, you know, do you know why it's called masticha and where does it come from and whatever.
Yeah, from here.
I made a connection, which I'm pretty, you'd probably know, Bunny Gotti. I made a connection in this. So obviously masticha, what most Greeks would call chewing gum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I made the connection with the word masticate, which is to chew. That's where it comes from.
That is where it comes from.
And I was thinking about it afterwards.
Yeah. Mm.
That's where it comes from, to masticate masticha tree.
Because
so there you go.
Most people back in the day
closed.
Didn't
fuck,
brush
I'll
their teeth.
To that.
Yamas.
Jeez,
yeah.
Mate.
You like
well
that
done,
one?
Tom?
Fuck. Nanakale heals with the masticha.
See the shit we come up with when we drink in this episode?
Most people didn't brush their teeth.
Mm.
So how do you avoid basically peeing people off with bad breath? Masticha. The fragrant tree grum, tree sap.
I couldn't believe it when I made that connection. I'm like, that must
that
be where it's
sense.
From.
Bravo, mate. Gadik series.
Gadik series. Okay, well.
There's digress. Three groups of epirotises we've got to mention.
Aha, here we go. Mm. Yep.
Number one of the suyotises. When Ali Pasha finally captured Suli,
mm-hmm.
after decades of independence, basically independence, the troops moved in. The last soldiers blew themselves up at Kungi, at the monastery at Kungi, mm-hmm. with Yeronda Samuil.
Yeah.
That's reenacted every July.
Hang on, say that again.
You know Kungi.
No.
It's not far from the peninsula.
How much have you had to drink?
I don't know. A lot. It's been a long day. So they reenact that every
they
year.
They reenact it. They put a mock.
Because in Parga, they do it in Parga as well, I thought. Anyway, let me think about it a bit more, but it does ring a bell. I'm trying to work out where I've seen it.
Gathered all whatever gunpowder they had left.
Yeah.
Bika and Mesa, sorry, automatically going to Greek.
Mm-hmm.
The Ottoman troops roll into the monastery and he blows the whole thing up.
Yeah.
The last of the Suyotis fighters, the ones who didn't escape to Kerkera, which is why so many southern Kerkera have Epirotika surnames like Botsis.
And they're all in Benitzes as well.
Mm, and your family's married to one or two of them.
Correct, yep.
The women gathered at a place called Zalongo, where rather than surrendering, they threw themselves and their babies off the cliff.
Yeah.
Big statue, big monument there up there.
Yeah.
It's not reenacted, but it is commemorated. And I'm glad that our Epirotika Society here in Sydney did a commemoration for it for the 200 years last.
Yeah. And Yanni was there.
220 years
Yanni
last year.
Yanni Malikuti was there as well.
Yeah, our Consul General was there as
well.
So
it's actually a song. It's a song. Yeah. It's a dance. And all the elders got together. They could see the Ottomans climbing up this mountain. And their fate was, look, we're going to be slaves. We're
you get the harem straight away.
What do we do? And the elders got together and they made a call. They said, listen, we're not going to surrender to these guys. We're just going to fight to the end. And they actually threw their children off first.
Mm.
And then they did this dance. And then everyone on the ground could see what was happening. And that's how the story has lived and survived. And there's an American battalion that did a song on it. And I saw it on the internet.
I haven't heard that.
Yeah, so it was a beautiful singer. She sang the song, and I've got to look up it. You know, I'm not doing it justice, but I've got to look into it a bit more. But yeah, it's an amazing story.
The Suyotises are one. Two, a few years later, again, from, I don't know how far Yohoyo is from Blesion, Thesprotias, it's not far. It's Paramithia district, so it's not far. That's Australia's first Greek female migrant was from there.
Oh, right.
She was born in that
from Paramithia.
The Chorio Plesio, which is Paramithia district. So not Suli, it's underneath. Yeah. It's in the foothills around Suli.
Yeah.
Well,
Paramithia is famous for Vulgari as well.
Yep, the Bulgari family.
Mm. Yeah, so he was a...
Oh, Vulgaris.
Yeah, he was a, what, tin, copper, he must make jewellery.
He was a
stuff.
Smith. Metal smith.
His shop is still there today.
The original one,
The original one, yeah.
The original one, yeah.
So he ended up going to Italy. Vulgari is huge now. One of their grandsons, I think he's called Spiro. He's got a Greek name. And it wasn't long ago, several years ago.
Yeah, they visited.
They came back in a helicopter. They landed. They donated money to the village. And anyway, sorry, mate.
He would have been... He probably, to get the name Vulgaris, he probably would have had some connection with Bulgaria. So, not national, but probably business trade.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Plesa's, Katerini Plesa, who became Catherine Crummer, her father had business over in Ceres. He would go from the Choria Paramithia to Ceres, a wandering merchant. Somehow, I don't know how, I haven't been able to figure it out, she ended up at the court of Ali Pasha, where her mother was Ali Pasha's son's mistress.
Right. So Catherine's mother.
Catherine's mother, who happened to be named Vasiliki. Not to be confused with Kira Vasiliki. They're two separate women.
Okay.
So, both called Vasiliki, separate women.
Okay.
Her house was near Ayamarina, the church of Ayamarina. You know, Lizharitsia, the old fortress in Yona, where the 5th division is.
Where
the military base is.
Yep.
That fortress which looks out over the lake, there's a church underneath it, Ayamarina.
That
was her neighborhood. Her house was around there.
Okay.
Vasiliki engages her daughter, Ekaterini Rusho. Rusho is epirotico for redhead, Ranga.
Right.
She was apparently quite beautiful and a redhead. Women about 13 at this time, 12, 13. So just becoming into womanhood. Ali was looking at her a bit too strangely for her mother's taste. So she engages her daughter to a guy called Dr. Ioannis Koletis, Ali Pasha's personal physician, who went on to become one of Greece's first prime ministers, in Epiroti. Ali Pasha's revolt happens, as we said, and then somehow she ends up in Mesolongi during the sieges of Mesolongi. And she's staying with an uncle, Theodora, was it literally an uncle or someone from the Horio, don't know, called Yorios Kitsos, who was very good mate with Lord Byron.
Okay. Oh, there you go.
And Lord Byron was staying in the same house. That's the house Lord Byron died in. He died of fever. Well, that's the official story anyway. God knows what disease he picked up.
Yeah, there you go.
You want to know what Byron got up to? You just have to read the memoirs of Shelley.
So he ended up dying in Mesolongi.
He died in Mesolongi officially a fever. It was 1824.
But he fought in the independence for Greece.
He fought a little bit. He got sick, basically. He couldn't handle it because back then Mesolongi was a malarial swamp. Malaria was a serious issue. But his big contribution was he left his entire estate to the freedom struggle.
Oh, right.
Every penny was given to the War of Independence.
Because we've got a few statues of him in Greece.
There's more statues of Byron in Greece than there are in the UK.
Oh, there you go.
They were kind of embarrassed of him. The Poms were kind of embarrassed of him.
Us Greeks, we take anyone.
Anyone that helps us anyway.
Yeah.
But we never forget it. If they help, we never forget it.
Yeah.
She gets out before the exodus or the collapse of Mesolongi in 1826.
Yeah,
she gets out.
Yep.
She goes to a little island called Kalamos, just literally 1 kilometer off the coast of Mytikka.
Okay.
So literally, you can almost swim it.
Really?
A strong swimmer can go across.
Sure.
She falls in love with, or he falls in love with her, the British commander. Well, he was actually Irish, but he was British Army commander.
Yeah.
They get married. She's about 17. He then relocates with his unit to Kerikera, where they have their first daughter, Amelia.
Yeah.
And this is where the Americans will be interested. Amelia died on one of her husband's business trips. Her husband, she ended up marrying, believe it or not, in Newcastle.
All right.
Newcastle up here, Sydney.
Just here.
We've been told about this before, actually.
She died at Niagara Falls.
Was it you that was telling us this the last time?
I'm not sure if it was last time or if it was off camera.
Hang on. So Catherine died in Niagara
Falls. No.
Sorry.
Catherine's daughter, Amelia.
Catherine's daughter, Amelia, died in... Newcastle.
They're firstborn. Born in Kerikera.
Yeah.
Dad, Irish. Mum, Epirotisa. Comes to Australia, marries a sea captain. On one of his trips over to the United States, to New York, they go for a... Between journeys, go to Niagara Falls for a holiday. She catches some virus, disease, whatever, and dies. And her grave is still there at Niagara Falls.
Wow.
On the American side.
How's that for a connection? Corfu, amazing. Australia, US. Oh, they're all connected.
Absolutely.
What a story.
Catherine Crummer, they leave Kerikera. They go... Ireland, England. He gets posted eventually to Newcastle, Port Macquarie, Maitland, all these country towns around northern New South Wales. He dies 1864. He was a veteran of Waterloo. He was at the Battle of Waterloo.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. So he's got a whole story. She then moves with her sons to what we now call the Rialto Terrace, it used to be called. They widened it. You know the Coca-Cola sign at King's Cross?
Yeah.
Now the underpass?
Yeah, the underbridge.
That used to be a neighbourhood.
Oh,
they,
right.
They destroyed the whole neighbourhood of houses, including Shit. Where she used to live, to open the road to Rushcutters Bay and places beyond.
Oh, right.
She died August 8th of August 1907, about the age of 98. She's buried over here at Waverley Cemetery.
All right.
Wow, okay.
So if you ever do that walk, that cliff...
The coastal walk.
The coastal walk, you'll see in the far corner next to the walk a grave that looks like a Greek temple.
Okay.
That's actually James Martin, the former Lord Mayor of Sydney. That's his grave. Her grave is a couple of rows up, and on her grave is a little plaque by the Lord Byron Society. We believe she was the last living person to have met Lord Byron. Well, think about it, 1907. He died 1824.
Amazing.
So she probably was the last living person to have met him.
Wow.
Oh,
I do that walk. It's an amazing walk.
It's a beautiful walk.
For people who aren't from Sydney, it's just along
Google
the coast.
It. If you're not from Sydney, Google it. It's even the footage is stunning.
I do go through there. So Hargraves is from... There's a couple of famous people buried
Lawrence
there.
Hargrave is
yeah,
in
Lawrence
there.
Hargraves.
The first Orthodox Papa permanently based in Australia is there with
really?
His wife and his daughter.
So there's a bit of a Greek connection in that
cemetery. Oh, there's
huge...
In the Independence section over the southern side of the cemetery, it's full of early, early Greek graves. Mm. The first president of the Kinotita and his family, the Komino family.
Oh, I've got to go check it out. Because that overlooks the Pacific Ocean. Amazing
yeah.
for that. Look, we are digressing again.
We are digressing.
And so that's Catherine Crummer.
The last group, of course, are the Birotisers of 1940.
World War II, definitely.
World War II.
Yeah, exactly. Carried all the ammunition, the weapons up to the front line.
Supplies, carried the wounded back.
Yeah.
Carried water up to the soldiers in the warmer
yeah.
months.
Yeah.
Towards the end of the campaign. Because the... Okay, 28th of October, the Italians, the fascists, Mussolini's people mm-hmm. invade. They thought there'd be a cakewalk.
Yeah.
Stunning stories. I was listening to the biography of the Chalkias musicians, the clarinet players.
Mm-hmm.
And Petros Chalkias, mm-hmm. one of the older brothers, he yep. lost his first wife and first children in an Italian air raid on Yanina.
Oh, really?
What we now call Platea Parigis. So that back part
yep.
of downtown area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That used to be Ftocho Gitonia, a real slum.
Yeah.
Working class, real working class area. And they bombed it.
I didn't know
and
that.
He lost his wife and his first two children.
Mm.
Married again a few years later.
Apparently, Igoumenitsa got carpet bombed too by the Italians.
It's a port.
Makes
it's a
sense.
Port. But Amethyar had an airstrip in World War II.
Yeah.
And here's something I'll mention it now. Roald Dahl was one of the James and the Giant Peach, Charlie
yes.
Chocolate Factory.
Yeah, yeah, the books.
He was a pilot who
this.
Flew out of Paramithiar.
Really?
Paramithiar had an airstrip in World War II.
Shit.
He was part of the bombing of Athens. He bombed an airstrip, Roald Dahl.
Wow.
When he was in the RAF, the Royal Air Force.
Mm.
So the Birotisers would literally carry everything, and they held the front. The Greek army didn't just hold the front. The Greek army actually advanced and liberated northern Epiros.
Yeah.
And the only reason they had to eventually surrender is because the Nazis came in through Bulgaria and Yugoslavia.
Mm.
All the Greek forces were on the Epiros front.
Yeah.
So the Australians, the second generation Anzacs and the British were posted over on the other side. Couldn't hold it.
Mm.
Nobody could hold it against the Luftwaffe anyway.
Yeah.
They got the Air Force just bombed the crap out of them.
Yeah.
So they did retreat.
Mm.
But when we talk about Epiros, well, we talk about any part of Greece.
But they were very fierce resistance fighters.
There's a friend of mine that's doing a series of paintings now about women figures. Not only of 1821,
right.
but of 20th, but earlier and later.
Yeah.
So there's another. There's
amazing. Another story.
Greek women.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Far out.
We can talk about stuff forever, but.
I know. Well, look, we could talk forever.
We could,
yeah,
but we shouldn't.
Yeah.
No.
The clarino actually came into the Greek world via Epiro.
Mm.
And that's again because of the diaspora.
Yeah. Oh, right. I thought it was
because originally the traditional instrument of Epiro is the pipiza or the zurna.
Mm. Okay, what are they?
Primitive clarinets.
Okay.
They're wind instruments, but very high pitched and very simple.
Mm.
Basically, like a recorder or a flute.
Yeah. Mm.
All right. Very simple instruments.
Yeah.
These were then borrowed, taken with them when they moved, particularly to Austria, Hungary, and Italy.
Okay. And they formed the
where clarinet. The locals played around with it and invented the clarinet. And these people then brought it back. The Ipiro is the gateway for the clarinet to be introduced into Greek music. The Chalkias family are obviously the most famous, identified with Ipirotiki musiki.
Yeah.
Originally, they weren't musicians. What were they? Chalkos is
bronze, isn't it?
Bronze,
oh,
or
bronze.
Copper.
Oh.
They were tinsmiths. They were metal workers.
Okay.
You couldn't make a living back in the day out of being a musician.
Yeah. You still can't.
Because of the diaspora, the huge number of Ipirotes over in the United States, they invite someone over to do a concert, Petro Luka Chalkias. We're talking about now 1960s. 1950s, or like 1950s.
Still alive? Right.
Petro Luka is still playing music.
Wow.
Alongside his grandson. Not just his son, his grandson.
Yeah. Well, it is a wind instrument because
it is a wind instrument.
When you go to the mountains of Ipiro, you do hear that ooh sound when wind goes through the mountains, and it does sound like a clarinet-y sound as well. So
especially in winter, yes.
Yeah,
when those really strong northern winds come through.
Yeah, and they go through the trees. It does sound that clarinet-y sound. But yeah,
definitely.
Amazing.
And Petr Luka's over in the States. He's doing it, I think, it's on the video that I watched the other day. I think it was New York, somewhere around New York, New York, New Jersey, somewhere in that corner. And he gets notified that this big American, this doyen of American clarinet jazz is going to come and listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
Petr Luka can't read music.
Yeah.
He cannot read a single note.
Wow, just by sound.
Everything is by sound. All these old people, they didn't read music. Everything was from the ear.
Yeah.
They listen to everything. They listen to the pitch.
Yeah, well, Tom's like that. Tom's got super hearing. I don't know how you pick up some of that stuff. Like, we'd be listening to something and Tom goes, aha, did you hear that? I go, what? You what? And he goes, he played a wrong key. I go, what the fuck are you talking about? Wrong note. Anyway, we'd go back and then he'd have to put it full blast and I'd hear, I go, how the hell did you pick that up? So, supersonic hearing, this guy.
Look.
So you can't whisper in a corner.
Musicians have a particular ear. Cooks, chefs have a particular palate.
But see, the funny thing is, for me, being from Gedikida is really well known for its music. And
yeah,
being, you know,
very Italian influence, yeah.
Correct. And also, they've got the music university there.
Mm.
I go over there, and my family name is associated with music over there. But they don't think I'm a musician over there because I can't read music. It's a very different approach there.
That's a very Western, very
it's very Europe, yeah, very Western European approach to it.
I mean, you look at ecclesiastical music, the way it's written, it's completely different annotation system to the way that the West uses.
Yep.
Or that they teach at the university, the way they teach music, the whole way they use the sounds are completely different.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I want to come back to Chalkia. He does the concert, and this big, I was deliberately not mentioning the name yet, this big American. And he is. When you hear the name, you will freak. Unless you already know the story.
I don't, but we'll try and guess.
He meets with Petr Luka. Petr Luka at this time is 40-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, I thought I knew how to play a clarinet. You just taught me that I've got a lot to learn.
Mm.
It was Benny Goodman.
Right.
Now, anybody that knows anything about jazz music or music... Well, no, that's a freakish thing for Benny Goodman to have said. Benny Goodman was another big American name that Chalkia paid for because he went there for a concert tour.
Yeah.
He stayed there 20 years. The Ipirotes wouldn't let him go.
Yeah.
They missed home.
Yeah.
And he was just like in a couple of weekends, we've got Melinas Lanidou coming to Sydney.
Mm.
The Ponians are going nuts.
Yeah, they absolutely love it. Yeah, the last time she was here, they were the first group. Basically, they were at the airport to welcome her.
They go nuts because it's home. And the really freaky thing is that a lot of the kids that go to the airport to see her are third, fourth generation Australian.
Absolutely.
Let alone the sixth, seventh generation after Pondos, after the genocide. But they still identify as Pondian. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Another one that Chalkia played with was Satchmo, Louis Armstrong.
Wow.
So we're talking about... top.
Yeah, this is the elite.
This is music royalty. Yeah, don't worry about Swifties and Sakhalamares, the sugar Sakhalamares today. These are serious musicians.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they say that Manolis Xiotis was called out by Jimi Hendrix. There's conflicting reports about whether that actually happened or not, but we're taking it. It really says a lot about the abilities of these people,
yeah,
you know, the Greeks in general when it comes to music. But those two names that you've just mentioned there, like,
huge.
You can't,
and these
you
are verifiable.
Yeah.
There are photos, there are eyewitness accounts of these people actually met and jammed, as they say, together.
Yeah.
For me, if I have one whinge about the modern Greek state, they do not teach anywhere near enough about the diaspora. We're always, us here outside, we're always talking about, tonight, we're talking about Epiros.
Sure. It's a great point.
Yeah.
But they don't talk about the Epirotes outside. Or the Gergeri, or whatever it is, particularly here in Australia. Because it's like, what in the world? It's like the other side of the planet.
That's a great point.
New York Troyete, but
you as an educator now, as a history teacher, let's say, do you foresee a time in the future where you'll conceivably go to a classroom in Greece and there's a textbook that talks about, here's what the diaspora and our connection to us is?
Yes. Because it started.
It has to happen, doesn't it?
It started a little bit with the War of Independence, the role of the diaspora.
Because there were Americans that fought in the War of Independence as well.
There were former slaves that fought in the War of Independence. There are paintings of the classic one. I can never remember the guy's name, and I really should. He's buried in, I think he's buried in Nafplio. African-American, full, Mavro, Pisa, in a fustanella.
Yeah, wow. Really?
There's a painting of him. I think the Greek Americans honored him, did a ceremony at his grave in Nafplio a few years ago. These connections are beginning to come out, and now that the Greek state has finally accepted that we who pay taxes in Greece should be allowed to participate in a vote,
yep.
I think this is going to open up diaspora history, the diaspora experience more to the people in Greece. And it's basically because of, now we've got the internet, that immediacy of connection, podcasts like this, which I heard in Greece. Now, like, we've got people like that in Australia. I thought Australia was Mau Mau, barbecue, and maybe some prawns.
Yeah, was it James Jacob Williams?
No, thank you.
There you go. Good job.
Do a Google image. You should find the portrait, the painting of him with the fustanella. It's stunning.
Yeah.
A former slave.
Fighting in the War of Independence.
Who's fought in the war for somebody else's independence.
Yeah.
When you talk about the War of Independence, it'll come up, but I'll throw it out there now. Haiti was the first country to recognize Greek independence.
Haiti.
Jeez. There you go. Yeah, there's a photo.
You found him, huh?
Yep.
You found it?
It's everywhere.
You're becoming our shit Jamie.
Wise Fasten.
Love it. Wow.
There you go. No, good shot of him. There you go. Shit so, Jamie. Or we're going to call him the Kolobodo.
Yeah,
someone to do all this stuff while we're talking.
Oh,
yeah, wow. No, that's fascinating.
I'd be happy to do that. I'd be happy to sit here and have a sip water and just do the Googling.
Be careful what you wish for, mate.
Yeah, definitely. No, right. Fantastic.
Well, I'm sure that we could continue going for the
we
next
could,
6 years.
We could,
and we've probably left out a lot as well.
We have.
We can talk about Thanasios, the Arkos, and a couple
others. We didn't talk about what's that, his family. We didn't talk about the Zavellos family. We didn't talk about the Katara. I should have brought up the Katara. That's when I got distracted.
Yeah.
The main pass, the main road before the Agnatia, over between Meteora and Yanina.
Istrofitis Kataras?
Istrofitis Kataras. Yeah. It's called the Katara.
Oh, right.
The cursed place.
Really?
And I've heard different versions of it. I've heard it was a papa. I've heard it was a monacho. I've heard it was a bishop.
Yeah.
But it was some cleric who was going through there in spring or early summer, get smashed in a snowstorm up there.
Yeah.
And he goes, it's June or May. It's some warm season. Why is there a snowstorm? This place is cursed.
Yeah.
And the name stuck.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, just on that name, though, that's that's one of the lines my wife always comes out with when there's someone in front of you that's, you know, that's either trying to park or drives like shit.
And because if you haven't been there, you don't understand just how dangerous that road is.
Yeah, it gets icy and
even when it's dry, it's just so narrow and curvy. It's dangerous. So
exactly. But I love it. Nah, look, what a place you put on. And look, me and you were talking, we're texting as well. I think you cursed me for posting photos of the amazing beaches we've got.
Yep, I did.
And you said, Nick, stop telling the world about this place.
Yes. I posted that comment, yes.
Yeah.
Because I don't want them stuffing it up like they've done to so many parts of Greece.
Yeah. And it is. It's a fucking amazing place. It's like where the mountain meets the ocean, the water, and the waters are beautiful. And that's why I want to go back every year now. Or I am going back every year.
Yeah. Definitely should.
No, fantastic. Look, what a great chat. What a great discussion. Like I said, I think we've done a little bit of justice of Ipiro, but there's so much more that we could have talked about. But,
definitely. Well, you're not going anywhere. We'll be coming back, obviously, at some point.
That's up to the audience if they want to hear more Saklamatis.
I'm sure they will. And they're not Saklamatis, let's be honest.
No, this quality stuff, mate.
Well, Panayoti, thank you so much for coming here and giving Nick a little bit of support when it comes to this topic. You've both done a great job. Well done.
When the episode is released, I'm going to be sharing it everywhere like I did last time, but with one hashtag: Ipirotes are the best.
Love it.
Why Ipirotes are the best?
It's going to be trending.
And what about the mullet? My God, that's the best story.
All right, guys. Well, uzotalk@outlook.com is the email. Follow us on social media @uzotalk and @uzo_talk. Panayotis Diamandis, Nick Athanasiou, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Tune in
again. Same bat time, same bat channel.
See everyone.
Ακολουθήστε μας στο Soundees, στο Spotify, στο Apple Podcasts και στο Google Podcasts.